Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
Known as C Murder, was sentenced today after a jury in Jefferson Parish convicted him on second-degree murder charges. This was the second trial for Corey Miller, who was convicted in the first trial, but that conviction was overturned. Now in this second trial, he was found guilty a second time for the killing of 16-year-old Steve Thomas at an outclosed club across the river. This conviction carries with it an automatic life sentence, and our Katie Moore is outside the courthouse now. And were there any surprises at today's sentencing, Katie?
No real surprises, Eric, but it was an emotional day for all of the families involved in this case. This morning, both the parents of Steve Thomas took the witness stand and made emotional victim impact statements to the court and to Corey Miller in court. Now, again, Corey Miller was facing second-degree murder charges in the shooting of Steve Thomas in a Harvey nightclub in 2002. Miller's family filled up a row of the courtroom as he sat in the custody of sheriff's deputies in an orange prison jumpsuit and his gold-rimmed glasses. Miller's family quietly left the courtroom just after 11:30 this morning, a somber day for them, and we're just moments ago saw Steve Thomas's family come out of the courtroom. In court, however, Thomas's mother, Dolores, cried as she made a victim impact statement to the court. She told them, quote, "It has been seven long, long, long years for us with no closure." She continued, "For us as parents, the grieving process has never ended. We still cry every day." And at one point, Thomas's father addressed Miller's family in court. Here's how Corey Miller's sister reacted to that.
I felt what he said because we lost one 18 years ago. I'm sorry. But my brother's still innocent. So they'll tell you somebody's still out there is the murderer. You know, I feel sorry for their family and I pray for them. 18 years ago, my brother died, and we know who killed him.
Now, Miller's attorney, Ron Rakowski, filed, of course, a motion for a new trial today. He also filed a motion to appeal the conviction in this case. Originally, during testimony and during the case and during those deliberations of the jury, he had filed a motion for a new trial. He amended that motion today, saying things like this non-unanimous verdict violated Corey Miller's constitutional rights, something that has already vetted its way through the Supreme Court. So whether or not that will go anywhere, whether or not that will gain any traction, will have to be seen in the next few weeks and months. Reporting live from Jefferson Parish, Katie Moore, Channel 4.
Context of white supremacy, justice. Gusty Renegade, in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, June 28th, 2013, so I have been told. We will be back tomorrow. Saturday, the compensatory call-in. Busy week. President Obama on the continent. First week of the George Zimmerman trial. Gay rights juggernaut. Paula Deen is still the talk of the town, getting more victims to be character witnesses for her. quite a week on the plantation. Tune in tomorrow. Definitely want to pick back up on the conversation about sharing in the workplace and the best way to solve problems without creating new problems on the job. Participate tomorrow, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. I want to give out the address again. I think Mr. Scotty Reed, Black Talk Radio Network, I think he hooked us up and even put a link on the page at Black Talk Radio Network for the cows with the flash phone. I think it might be right there where you can click it from the page and dial into the program. You can either listen or you can participate. If it is not there, you can always use the link, which is tiny.cc/oneRace. If there's ever a problem with the player on the Black Talk Radio page, or if you want to participate, you don't have minutes, you don't have a phone, whatever, tiny.cc/oneRace. You can download the app, use it on your smartphone, mobile device, and you can dial in with that. You can listen. Even if you don't want to participate, you can listen. You'll see the button on the right side of the page. It's a blue button for a download app. You also can use the flash phone that's right there. Button is on the left side of the page. Press it. It will open up a small window with a phone. All you have to do is the first line. It will have the phone number to dial in. Drop down menu, pick the number that we've been giving out for years, 760-569-7676. Then the next line down where it says the code, 564-943. First line is the number, second line is the code. The third line, you can put in a handle, name, whatever, if you would like. You do not have to enter a name at all. You can leave it blank and just go ahead and press the green button at the bottom of that little window. It'll connect you to the program. You'll be able to listen on your computer. You can do the same thing if you download the app for your mobile device. You can participate. All you have to do is press *6. It'll give you an audio prompt. Press 1, I'll see your hand and you can participate, but it's free. You don't have to download anything. It should work anywhere in the world, and it should be much more reliable than Skype. I'll give it out a few more times as we go, but that is a very easy, free way to listen and or participate in the program. Before we begin, third installment of Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People. Little contrast programming at the beginning. I want to be clear, I am not in any way, shape, or form ridiculing, teasing, minimizing Mr. Miller, Corey Miller, also known as C. Murder, him being in greater confinement. He's a victim of racism. He's a black male. I don't see anything to cheer about a victim of racism being in greater confinement. I played those audio clips for contrast programming. I think that the system of racism, white supremacy, white people, they groom us to be hostile, combative, in conflict with other non-white people. Everything that is aimed at non-white people is for us to take out all of our frustrations and anger about being terrorized by whites every day, and for generations to take that out on other victims. In fact, I have got an F for consecutive weeks. This is, you know, really bad. I prefer to spend at least 15 hours per week going through the news. That's like total reading the newspaper. If I listen to any news programs, if I watch any news segments, like at least 15 hours per week, just looking for information, any new information that comes out, any reports, that way. And I still feel like that's nothing. I still feel super ignorant and poorly informed about pretty much everything. But this is consecutive weeks where I haven't been able to spend as much time, and it's just been so many things happening the past a couple weeks, I could have spent 15 hours on Paula Deen material alone. But I'll tell you one thing that stood out. President Obama has been in Africa. Amy Goodman, you know I love Amy Goodman. Amy Goodman, and this was just today, this was just a few hours before we went live. Amy Goodman on Democracy Now!, she had a victim of racism. He's a black male. I think he's a professor, author, and he was talking about President Obama's trip to Africa, where he's visiting, and the timing with former President Mandela's poor health and what might happen there. And it was a lot of, you know, President Obama didn't say anything about slavery. He was right there at the door of no return, where our ancestors were shackled and stolen from the continent. He didn't say anything about that. He didn't say anything about reparations. And I mean, all of that is true. He did not. He had some other criticisms as well. But in my view, this is the overall, this is what's supposed to happen, where you get Amy Goodman, who is a quote unquote good white person. Not racist, of course. She gets to sit back and say nothing. A victim of racism can complain and point the finger. All of this is supposed to be blamed on another victim of racism. This is the exact sort of thing that I think white people are going to be setting up left and right, left and right. If you want to use a pool analogy, if we were on the pool table, a la Dr. Welsing, it would be taking the white cue ball and banging one of the other non-white balls into a different non-white ball to make it go in the pocket. That's a lot of what white people are doing. And sometimes you have to do that on the pool board, folks who, you know, play the game. White people are doing lots of that, just banging one non-white person into another non-white person all day long and creating conflict, which is why I think this book is so important. But those audio clips, they saturate our environment. If you just contrast that song, and I could have included so much more. I was going to put in from Sanford and Son, Pam's favorite segment, Racism, WS.com, when she talks about Sanford and Son with Red Fox, when he calls the black female, Aunt Esther. He says, I could take your face and push it into some dough and make gorilla cookies. White people saturate our environment. Precious. All of that foolishness, they saturate our environment. Even silliness like the not the wood, Think Like a Man. So I talked about that before with Kevin Hart. Just a lot of black people being very silly, very discourteous, and all in the guise of this is a joke, we're just messing around, or we do that, this is the dozens, this is a part of our culture. I've heard all those sorts of excuses, and it breeds and it feeds into that conflict, because you got people that are already upset. They are already close to the breaking point with what white people have put on us. Anybody spent any time watching George Zimmerman's trial this week, and you saw Trayvon Martin's parents or his black female friend, last person to speak with him over the phone. If you saw any of that, I mean, you know, black people are under some stress. Victims of racism are under stress. So to be traumatized and then to have people around you who are just using words like what you heard at the very beginning, and the way that we talk about other black people, even carelessly calling other black people nigger and things like that. Just little things, being a little bit more mindful of the way that we talk to one another, making an effort to not name call, making an effort to just watch your tone, making an effort to not criticize, resist the urge to criticize. If nothing else, I think we've heard Dale Carnegie in the first 2 weeks talk about how when you talk bad about other people, when you criticize other people, that can last for years. It can linger. I think he used that anecdote talking about Abraham Lincoln and how it led to a duel, almost cost him his life. Those sorts of little slights and snipes can snowball so quickly. Just making an effort to minimize those. I'm not going to be referencing, I'm not going to name call, I'm not going to be criticizing and talking bad about other non-white people. Just little things like that can go a long way, long, 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 long way to improving relationships with other non-white people. We will go ahead and get started. I hope people, if you listen to the cows, I hope when you hear some of these suggestions, If you have been listening to The Cows for a while, I hope you'll think, oh, wow, I think I've heard some of those techniques demonstrated. Not criticizing. Not every time we're not perfect. I'm certainly not perfect. But I hope, as someone who has read this book repeatedly, talked about this book, I chose this book for the session, I hope you at least can say, okay, I think I've heard a few times. Maybe not every time, but a few times. I think Gus, Justice, some of the other folks have used some of these techniques, and I've seen where maybe they've had some success. It didn't lead to conflict. It seemed like they were to maintain constructive dialogue, even with another confused victim. And that's really all it's about. Making sure we keep in mind that we're talking to victims of racism, people who have been harmed and are confused, and we really do want to do as much as we can to be patient, to not criticize, and to make them feel like they're important. I think that's going to be a big theme that he's going to talk about this week, making people feel like they are important. And I guarantee you do not accomplish that by criticizing. We will get started. Dale Carnegie, Kanye West in the background. That has been paying off well for me, not criticizing. I was able to do my video, and I just finished my album review without criticizing. I was really making a conscious effort to not talk bad about Kanye West. I didn't want to make it seem like I was criticizing another victim. And I think that that has been helpful. I think that enabled some non-white people to watch and learn and not feel like they needed to stick up for Kanye West being attacked because I didn't want to make an effort to attack another victim of racism. You can check out both and let me know if that's accurate or not. We will get started. Dale Carnegie, How to Win Friends and Influence People, segment number 3, Context of White Supremacy.
People are so proud of their names that they strive to perpetuate them at any cost. Even blustering, hard-boiled old P.T. Barnum, the greatest showman of his time, disappointed because he had no sons to carry on his name, offered his grandson, C.H. Seeley, $25,000 if he would call himself Barnum Seeley. For many centuries, nobles and magnates supported artists, musicians, and authors so that their creative works would be dedicated to them. Libraries and museums owe their richest collections to people who cannot bear to think that their names might perish from the memory of the race. The New York Public Library has its Astor and Lennox collections. The Metropolitan Museum perpetuates the name of Benjamin Altman and J.P. Morgan. And nearly every church is beautified by stained glass windows commemorating the names of their donors. Many of the buildings on the campuses of most universities bear the names of donors who contributed large sums of money for this honor. Most people don't remember names for the simple reason that they don't take the time and energy necessary to concentrate and repeat and fix names indelibly in their minds. They make excuses for themselves. They're too busy. But they were probably no busier than Franklin D. Roosevelt, and he took time to remember and recall even the names of mechanics with whom he came into contact. To illustrate, the Chrysler organization built a special car for Mr. Roosevelt, who could not use a standard car because his legs were paralyzed. W. F. Chamberlain, and a mechanic, delivered it to the White House. I have in front of me a letter from Mr. Chamberlain relating his experiences. I taught President Roosevelt how to handle a car with a lot of unusual gadgets, but he taught me a lot about the fine art of handling people. When I called at the White House, Mr. Chamberlain writes, the President was extremely pleasant and cheerful. He called me by name, made me feel very comfortable, and particularly impressed me with the fact that he was vitally interested in the things I had to show him and tell him. The car was so designed that it could be operated entirely by hand. A crowd gathered round to look at the car, and he remarked, I think it's marvelous. All you have to do is touch a button, and it moves away, and you can drive it without effort. I think it's grand. I don't know what makes it go. I'd love to have the time to tear it down and see how it works. When Mr. Roosevelt's friends and associates admired the machine, he said in their presence, Mr. Chamberlain, I certainly appreciate all the time and effort you've spent in developing this car. It's a mighty fine job. He admired the radiator, the special rear-vision mirror and clock, the special spotlight, the kind of upholstery, the sitting position of the driver's seat, the special suitcases in the trunk with his monogram on each suitcase. In other words, he took notice of every detail to which he knew I had given considerable thought. He made a point of bringing these various pieces of equipment to the attention of Mrs. Roosevelt, Miss Perkins, the Secretary of Labor, and his secretary. He even brought the old White House porter into the picture by saying, "George, you want to take particularly good care of these suitcases." When the driving lesson was finished, the president turned to me and he said, "Well, Mr. Chamberlain, I've been keeping the Federal Reserve Board waiting 30 minutes. I guess I had better get back to work." Now, I took a mechanic with me to the White House. He was introduced to Roosevelt when he first arrived. He didn't talk to the president, and Roosevelt heard his name only once. He was a shy chap, and he kept in the background. But before leaving us, the president looked for the mechanic, shook his hand, called him by name, and thanked him for coming to Washington. And there was nothing perfunctory about his thanks. He meant what he said. I could feel that. A few days after returning to New York, I got an autographed photograph of President Roosevelt and a little note of thanks, again expressing his appreciation for my assistance. How he found time to do it is a mystery to me. Franklin D. Roosevelt knew that one of the simplest, most obvious, and most important ways of gaining goodwill was by remembering names and making people feel important. Yet how many of us do it? Half the time we are introduced to a stranger, we chat for a few minutes and can't even remember his or her name by the time we say goodbye. One of the first lessons a politician learns is this: to recall a voter's name is statesmanship, to forget it is oblivion. And the ability to remember names is almost as important in business and social contacts as it is in politics. Napoleon III, Emperor of France and nephew of the great Napoleon, boasted that in spite of all his royal duties, he could remember the name of every person he met. His technique? Simple. If he didn't hear the name distinctly, he said, "So sorry, I didn't get the name clearly." And then if it was an unusual name, he would say, "How is it spelled?" During the conversation, he took the trouble to repeat the name several times and tried to associate it in his mind with the person's features, expression, and general appearance. If the person was someone of importance, Napoleon went to even further pains. As soon as His Royal Highness was alone, he wrote the name down on a piece of paper, looked at it, concentrated on it, fixed it securely in his mind. Then he tore up the paper. In this way, he gained an eye impression of the name as well as an ear impression. All this takes time, but good manners, said Emerson, are made up of petty sacrifices. The importance of remembering and using names is not just the prerogative of kings and corporate executives. It works for all of us. Ken Nottingham, an employee of General Motors in Indiana, usually had lunch at the company cafeteria. He noticed that the woman who worked behind the counter always had a scowl on her face. She had been making sandwiches for about 2 hours, and I was just another sandwich to her. I told her what I wanted. She weighed out the ham on a little scale, and then she gave me one leaf of lettuce, a few potato chips, and handed them to me. The next day I went through the same line, same woman, same scowl. The only difference was I noticed her name tag. I smiled. I said, "Hello, Eunice." Then I told her what I wanted. Well, she forgot the scale, piled on the ham, gave me 3 leaves of lettuce, and heaped on the potato chips until they fell off the plate. We should be aware of the magic contained in a name and realize this single item is wholly and completely owned by the person with whom we are dealing, and nobody else. The name sets the individual apart. It makes him or her unique among all others. The information we are imparting, or the request we are making, takes on a special importance when we approach the situation with the name of the individual. From the waitress to the senior executive, the name will work magic as we deal with others. Principle 3. Remember that a person's name is to that person the sweetest and most important sound in any language. Chapter 4. An easy way to become a good conversationalist. Some time ago, I attended a bridge party. I don't play bridge, and there was a woman there who didn't play bridge either. And she had discovered that I had once been Lowell Thomas's manager before he went on the radio, and that I'd traveled in Europe a great deal while helping him prepare the illustrated travel talks he was then delivering. So she said, "Oh, Mr. Carnegie, I do want you to tell me about all the wonderful places you've visited and the sights you've seen." As we sat down on the sofa, she remarked that she and her husband had recently returned from a trip to Africa. Africa, I exclaimed. How interesting. I've always wanted to see Africa, but I never got there except for a 24-hour stay once in Algiers. Tell me, did you visit the big game country? Yes? How fortunate. I envy you. Do tell me about Africa. And that kept her talking for 45 minutes. She never again asked me where I had been or what I'd seen. She didn't want to hear me talk about my travels. All she wanted was an interested listener, so she could expand her ego and tell about where she had been. Was she unusual? No, many people are like that. For example, I met a distinguished botanist at a dinner party given by a New York book publisher. I'd never talked with a botanist before, and I found him fascinating. I literally sat on the edge of my chair and listened while he spoke of exotic plants and experiments in developing new forms of plant life and indoor gardens, and even told me astonishing facts about the humble potato. I had a small indoor garden of my own, and he was good enough to tell me how to solve some of my problems. As I said, we were at a dinner party. There must have been a dozen other guests, but I violated all of the canons of courtesy, ignored everyone else, and talked for hours to the botanist. Midnight came. I said goodnight to everyone and departed. The botanist then turned to our host and paid me several flattering compliments. I was most stimulating. I was this and I was that. And he ended by saying I was a most interesting conversationalist. An interesting conversationalist? Why, I had said hardly anything at all. I couldn't have said anything if I'd wanted to without changing the subject, for I didn't know any more about botany than I knew about the anatomy of a penguin. But I had done this. I had listened intently. I had listened because I was genuinely interested, and he felt it. Naturally, that pleased him. That kind of listening is one of the highest compliments we can pay anyone. Few human beings, wrote Jack Woodford in Strangers in Love, few human beings are proof against the implied flattery of rapt attention. I went even further than giving him rapt attention. I was hearty in my approbation and lavish in my praise. I told him that I had been immensely entertained and instructed, and I had. I told him I wished I had his knowledge, and I did. I told him that I should love to wander the fields with him, and I have. I told him I must see him again, and I did. And so I had him thinking of me as a good conversationalist, when in reality I had been merely a good listener, and had encouraged him to talk. What is the secret, the mystery of a successful business interview? Well, according to former Harvard President Charles W. Eliot, there is no mystery about successful business intercourse. Exclusive attention to the person who is speaking to you is very important. Nothing else is so flattering as that. Eliot himself was a past master of the art of listening. Henry James, one of America's first great novelists, recalled, "Dr. Eliot's listening was not mere silence, but a form of activity, sitting very erect on the end of his spine, with hands joined in his lap, making no movement except that he revolved his thumbs around each other, faster or slower. He faced his interlocutor and seemed to be hearing with his eyes as well as his ears. He listened with his mind and attentively considered what you had to say while you said it. At the end of an interview, the person who had talked to him felt that he had had his say." Self-evident, isn't it? You don't have to study for 4 years at Harvard to discover that. Yet I know, and you know, department store owners who will rent expensive space, buy their goods economically, dress their windows appealingly, spend thousands of dollars in advertising, and then hire clerks who haven't the sense to be good listeners. Clerks who interrupt customers, contradict them, irritate them, and all but drive them from the store. A department store in Chicago almost lost a regular customer who spent several thousand dollars each year in that store because a sales clerk wouldn't listen. Mrs. Henrietta Douglas, who took our course in Chicago, had purchased a coat at a special sale. After she brought it home, she noticed that there was a tear in the lining. She came back the next day and asked the sales clerk to exchange it. The clerk refused even to listen to her complaint. "You bought this at a special sale," she said. She pointed to a sign on the wall. "Read that," she explained. "All sales are final. Once you bought it, you have to keep it. Sew up the lining yourself." "But this was damaged merchandise," Mrs. Douglas complained. "Makes no difference," the clerk interrupted. "Final's final." Mrs. Douglas was about to walk out indignantly. swearing never to return to that store ever when she was greeted by the department manager, who knew her from her many years of patronage. Mrs. Douglas told her what had happened. The manager listened attentively to the whole story, examined the coat, and then said, "Special sales are final, so we can dispose of merchandise at the end of the season, but this no-return policy does not apply to damaged goods. We will certainly repair or replace the lining, or, if you prefer, give you your money back." What a difference in treatment. If that manager had not come along and listened to the customer, a long-term patron of that store could have been lost forever. Listening is just as important in one's home life as in the world of business. Millie Esposito of Croton-on-Hudson, New York, made it her business to listen carefully when one of her children wanted to speak with her. One evening, she was sitting in the kitchen with her son, Robert, and after a brief discussion of something that was on his mind, Robert said, "Mom, I know that you love me very much." Mrs. Esposito was touched and said, "Of course I love you very much. Did you doubt it?" And Robert responded, "No, but I really know you love me, because whenever I want to talk to you about something, you stop whatever you're doing and listen to me." The chronic kicker, even the most violent critic, will frequently soften and be subdued in the presence of a patient, sympathetic listener, a listener who will be silent while the irate fault finder dilates like a king cobra and spews the poison out of his system. To illustrate, the New York Telephone Company discovered a few years ago that it had to deal with one of the most vicious customers who ever cursed a customer service representative. And he did curse. He raved. He threatened to tear the phone out by its roots. He refused to pay certain charges that he declared were false. He wrote letters to the newspapers. He filed innumerable complaints with a public service commission, and he started several suits against the telephone company. At last, one of the company's most skillful troubleshooters was sent to interview this stormy petrel. This troubleshooter listened and let the cantankerous customer enjoy himself pouring out his tirade. The telephone representative listened and said yes and sympathized with his grievance. "He raved on and I listened for nearly 3 hours," the troubleshooter said, as he related his experiences before one of my classes. "And then I went back and listened some more. I interviewed him 4 times, and before the 4th visit was over, I had become a charter member of an organization he was starting. He called it the Telephone Subscribers Protective Association. I'm still a member of this organization, and so far as I know, I'm the only member in the world today besides Mr. Smith. I listened and sympathized with him on every point that he'd made during these interviews. He never had a telephone representative talk with him that way before, and he became almost friendly. The point on which I went to see him was not even mentioned on the 1st visit, nor was it mentioned on the 2nd or 3rd. But upon the 4th interview, I closed the case completely. He paid all his bills in full, and for the first time in the history of his difficulties with the telephone company, voluntarily withdrew his complaints from the Public Service Commission. Doubtless Mr. Smith had considered himself a holy crusader, defending public rights against callous exploitation. But in reality, what he'd really wanted was a feeling of importance. He got this feeling of importance, at first, by kicking and complaining. But as soon as he got his feeling of importance from a representative of the company, his imagined grievances vanished into thin air. One morning years ago, an angry customer stormed into the office of Julian F. Detmer, founder of the Detmer Woolen Company, which later became the world's largest distributor of woolens to the tailoring trade. "This man owed us a small sum of money," Mr. Detmer explained to me. "The customer denied it, but we knew he was wrong, so our credit department had insisted that he pay. After getting a number of letters from our credit department, he packed his grip, made a trip to Chicago, and hurried into my office to inform me not only that he was not going to pay that bill, but that he was never going to buy another dollar's worth of goods from the Detmer Woolen Company. I listened patiently to all he had to say. I was tempted to interrupt, but I realized that would be bad policy, so I let him talk himself out. When he finally simmered down and got in a receptive mood, I said quietly, 'I want to thank you for coming to Chicago to tell me about this. You've done me a great favor, for if our credit department has annoyed you, it may annoy other good customers, and that would be just too bad. Believe me, I'm far more eager to hear this than you are to tell it.' That was the last thing in the world he expected me to say. I think he was a trifle disappointed, because he'd come to Chicago to tell me a thing or two, and here I was thanking him instead of scrapping with him. I assured him we would wipe the charge off the books and forget it, because he was a very careful man with only one account to look after, while our clerks had to look after thousands. Therefore, he was less likely to be wrong than we were. I told him that I understood exactly how he felt, and if I were in his shoes, I should undoubtedly feel precisely as he did. Since he wasn't going to buy from us any more, I recommended some other woolen houses. In the past, we'd usually lunch together when he came to Chicago, so I invited him to have lunch with me this day. He accepted, reluctantly, but when we came back to the office, he placed a larger order than ever before. He returned home in a softened mood, and, wanting to be just as fair with us as we'd been with him, looked over his bills, found one that had been mislaid, and sent us a check with his apologies. Later, when his wife presented him with a baby boy, he gave his son the middle name of Detmer, and he remained a friend and customer of the house until his death 22 years afterward. Years ago, a poor Dutch immigrant boy washed the windows of a bakery shop after school to help support his family. His people were so poor that, in addition, he used to go out in the street with a basket every day and collect stray bits of coal that had fallen in the gutter where the coal wagons had delivered fuel. That boy, Edward Bach, never got more than 6 years of schooling in his life, yet eventually he made himself one of the most successful magazine editors in the history of American journalism. How did he do it? That is a long story, but how he got his start can be told briefly. He got his start by using the principles advocated in this chapter. He left school when he was 13 and became an office boy for Western Union, but he didn't for one moment give up the idea of an education. Instead, he started to educate himself. He saved his car fares and went without lunch until he had enough money to buy an encyclopedia of American biography. And then he did an unheard-of thing. He read the lives of famous people and wrote them, asking for additional information about their childhoods. He was a good listener. He asked famous people to tell him more about themselves. He wrote General James A. Garfield, who was then running for president, and asked if it was true that he was once a tow boy on a canal, and Garfield replied. He wrote General Grant asking about a certain battle, and Grant drew a map for him and invited this 14-year-old boy to dinner and spent the evening talking to him. Soon our Western Union messenger boy was corresponding with many of the most famous people in the nation, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Oliver Wendell Holmes, Longfellow, Mrs. Abraham Lincoln, Louisa May Alcott, General Sherman, and Jefferson Davis. Not only did he correspond with these distinguished people, but as soon as he got a vacation, he visited many of them as a welcome guest in their homes. This experience imbued him with a confidence that was invaluable. These men and women fired him with a vision and ambition that shaped his life. And all this, let me repeat, was made possible solely by the application of the principles we're discussing here. Isaac F. Markeson, a journalist who interviewed hundreds of celebrities, declared that many people fail to make a favorable impression because they don't listen attentively. They have been so much concerned with what they are going to say next, they do not keep their ears open. Very important people have told me they prefer good listeners to good talkers, but the ability to listen seems rarer than almost any other good trait. And not only important personages crave a good listener, but ordinary folks do, too. As the Reader's Digest once said, many persons call a doctor when all they want is an audience. During the darkest hours of the Civil War, Lincoln wrote to an old friend in Springfield, Illinois, asking him to come to Washington. Lincoln said he had some problems he wanted to discuss with him. The old neighbor called at the White House, and Lincoln talked to him for hours about the advisability of issuing a proclamation freeing the slaves. Lincoln went over all the arguments for and against such a move, and then read letters and newspaper articles, some denouncing him for not freeing the slaves, others denouncing him for fear he was going to free them. After talking for hours, Lincoln shook hands with his old neighbor, said good night, and sent him back to Illinois without even asking for his opinion. Lincoln had done all the talking himself. That seemed to clarify his mind. He seemed to feel easier after that talk, the old friend said. Lincoln hadn't wanted advice. He had wanted merely a friendly, sympathetic listener to whom he could unburden himself. That's what we all want when we're in trouble. That is frequently all the irritated customer wants, and the dissatisfied employee, or the hurt friend. One of the great listeners of modern times was Sigmund Freud. A man who met Freud described his manner of listening. It struck me so forcibly that I shall never forget him. He had qualities which I had never seen in any other man. Never had I seen such concentrated attention. There was none of that piercing, soul-penetrating gaze business. His eyes were mild and genial. His voice was low and kind. His gestures were few. But the attention he gave me, his appreciation of what I said, even when I said it badly, was extraordinary. You have no idea what it meant to be listened to like that. If you want to know how to make people shun you and laugh at you behind your back and even despise you, here's the recipe. Never listen to anyone for long. Talk incessantly about yourself. If you have an idea while the other person is talking, don't wait for him or her to finish. Burst right in and interrupt in the middle of a sentence. Do you know people like that? I do, unfortunately. And the astonishing part of it is that some of them are prominent. Bores, that is all they are. Bores intoxicated with their own egos, drunk with the sense of their own importance. People who talk only of themselves think only of themselves. And those people who think only of themselves, Dr. Nicholas Murray Butler, longtime president of Columbia University, said, are hopelessly uneducated. They are not educated, said Dr. Butler, no matter how instructed they may be. So, if you aspire to be a good conversationalist, be an attentive listener. To be interesting, be interested. Ask questions that other persons will enjoy answering. Encourage them to talk about themselves and their accomplishments. Remember that the people you're talking to are 100 times more interested in themselves and their wants and problems than they are in you and your problems. A person's toothache means more to that person than a famine in China which kills 1 million people. A boil on one's neck interests one more than 40 earthquakes in Africa. Think of that the next time you start a conversation. Principle 4. Be a good listener. Encourage others to talk about themselves. Chapter 5. How to Interest People. Everyone who was ever a guest of Theodore Roosevelt was astonished at the range and diversity of his knowledge. Whether his visitor was a cowboy or a rough rider, a New York politician or a diplomat, Roosevelt knew what to say. And how was it done? The answer was simple. Whenever Roosevelt expected a visitor, he sat up late the night before, reading up on the subject in which he knew his guest was particularly interested. For Roosevelt knew, as all leaders know, that the royal road to a person's heart is to talk about the things he or she treasures most. The genial William Lyon Phelps, essayist and professor of literature at Yale, learned this lesson early in life. When I was 8 years old and was spending a weekend visiting my Aunt Libby Lindsley at her home in Stratford on the Housatonic, he wrote in his Essay on Human Nature, a middle-aged man called one evening, and after a polite skirmish with my aunt, he devoted his attention to me. At that time, I happened to be excited about boats, and the visitor discussed the subject in a way that seemed to me particularly interesting. After he left, I spoke of him with enthusiasm. What a man! My aunt informed me he was a New York lawyer, that he cared nothing whatever about boats, that he took not the slightest interest in the subject. But why then did he talk all the time about boats? Because he is a gentleman. He saw you were interested in boats, and he talked about the things he knew would interest and please you. He made himself agreeable. And William Lyon Phelps added, I never forgot my aunt's remark. As I write this chapter, I have before me a letter from Edward L. Chaliff, who was active in Boy Scout work. One day I found I needed a favor, writes Mr. Chaliff. A big scout jamboree was coming off in Europe, and I wanted the president of one of the largest corporations in America to pay the expenses of one of my boys for the trip. Fortunately, just before I went down to see this man, I heard that he had drawn a check for $1 million, and that after it was canceled, he had it framed. So the first thing I did when I entered his office was to ask to see the check, a check for $1 million. I told him I never knew that anybody had ever written such a check, and that I wanted to tell my boys I'd actually seen a check for $1 million. He gladly showed it to me. I admired it and asked him to tell me all about how it happened to be drawn. You notice, don't you, that Mr. Chalop didn't begin by talking about the Boy Scouts or the Jamboree in Europe or what it was he wanted. He talked in terms of what interested the other man. And here's the result. Presently, the man I was interviewing said, "Oh, by the way, what was it you wanted to see me about?" So I told him. To my vast surprise, Mr. Chalop continues, he not only granted immediately what I asked for, but much more. I'd asked him to send only one boy to Europe, but he sent 5 boys and myself, gave me a letter of credit for $1,000, and told us to stay in Europe for 7 weeks. He also gave me letters of introduction to his branch presidents, putting them at our service, and he himself met us in Paris and showed us the town. Since then, he's given jobs to some of the boys whose parents were in want, and he's still active in our group. Yet I know if I hadn't found out what he was interested in and got him warmed up first, I wouldn't have found him one-tenth as easy to approach. Is this a valuable technique to use in business? Is it? Let's see. Take Henry G. Duvernoy of Duvernoy & Sons, a wholesale baking firm in New York. Mr. Duvernoy had been trying to sell bread to a certain New York hotel. He'd called on the manager every week for 4 years. He went to the same social affairs the manager attended. He even took rooms in the hotel and lived there in order to get the business. But he failed. "Then," said Mr. Duvernoy, "after studying human relations, I resolved to change my tactics. I decided to find out what interested this man, what caught his enthusiasm. I discovered he belonged to a society of hotel executives called the Hotel Greeters of America. He not only belonged, but his bubbling enthusiasm had made him president of the organization and president of the International Greeters. No matter where its conventions were held, he would be there. So when I saw him the next day, I began talking about the Greeters. What a response I got! What a response! He talked to me for 30 minutes about the Greeters, his tones vibrant with enthusiasm. I could plainly see that this society was not only his hobby, it was the passion of his life. Before I left his office, he had sold me a membership in his organization. In the meantime, I'd said nothing about bread, but a few days later, a steward of his hotel phoned me to come over with samples and prices. 'I don't know what you did to the old boy,' the steward greeted me, "'but he sure is sold on you.' Think of it. I'd been drumming at that man for 4 years, trying to get his business, and I'd still be drumming at him if I hadn't finally taken the trouble to find out what he was interested in and what he enjoyed talking about. Edward E. Harriman of Hagerstown, Maryland, chose to live in the beautiful Cumberland Valley of Maryland after he completed his military service. Unfortunately, at that time, there were few jobs available in the area. A little research uncovered the fact that a number of companies in the area were either owned or controlled by an unusual business maverick, R.J. Funkhauser, whose rise from poverty to riches intrigued Mr. Harriman. However, he was known for being inaccessible to job seekers. Mr. Harriman wrote, "I interviewed a number of people and found out that his major interest was anchored in his drive for power and money. Since he protected himself from people like me by use of a dedicated and stern secretary, I studied her interests and goals, and only then I paid an unannounced visit at her office. She had been Mr. Funkhauser's orbiting satellite for about 15 years. When I told her I had a proposition for him, which might translate itself into financial and political success for him, she became enthused. I also conversed with her about her constructive participation in his success. After this conversation, she arranged for me to meet Mr. Funkhauser. I entered his huge and impressive office, determined not to ask directly for a job. He was seated behind a large carved desk and thundered at me, 'How about it, young man?' I said, 'Mr. Funkhauser, I believe I can make money for you. he immediately rose and invited me to sit in one of the large upholstered chairs. I enumerated my ideas and the qualifications I had to realize these ideas, as well as how they would contribute to his personal success and that of his businesses. RJ, as he has become known to me, hired me at once, and for over 20 years I have grown in his enterprises and we both have prospered. Talking in terms of the other person's interests pays off for both parties. Howard Z. Herzig, a leader in the field of employee communications, has always followed this principle. When asked what reward he got from it, Mr. Herzig responded that he not only received a different reward from each person, but that in general, the reward had been an enlargement of his life each time he spoke to someone. Principle 5. Talk in terms of the other person's interests.
You probably want to turn your volume down. Context of white supremacy. Thank you all for being patient. Lots of difficulties getting the program rolling today. Perseverance. Perseverance. The number to dial is 760-569-7676. And the code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. The number one more time is 760-569-7676. And the code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Before we get to the hands that are up already, that last sentiment about paying attention to the other person's interests, very important with regards to racism, white supremacy. If you're trying to get other non-white people to focus on racism, white supremacy, white people as the problem, figuring out ways of making racism, white supremacy interesting for them. One to think about. Person that dialed in 3539. Your line should be open, 3539.
Peace, can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Peace, Gus, and all the other listeners. This principle 4 really hit home for me. It was about listening. And something I thought about immediately is when I'm at work, I have students, or I call them my children. There are times where they try to talk to me, and I'm usually trying to multitask, and so I don't devote my full attention to them, but listening to this principle, listening to this segment, really, I mean, I vow from this day forward to change that. I mean, it's not going to be easy because, you know, sometimes things are rushed and I am trying to do other things, but I'm going to vow today to stop what I'm doing to really devote my attention to them because I feel like just hearing that today, it's very important, again, to devote your entire attention to children, to adults. Whoever. So that really stood out for me and hit home. And then the second thing that hit home for me is when they were talking about prominent people that just talk and don't listen. He said something about they're not educated no matter how instructed they may be. And again, that hit home as well, just that quote, not educated no matter how instructed they may be. Because growing up and all that, people used to say, oh, you're just a know-it-all. You just, you know, talk like you know it all. And, I mean, I know even still now I'm working on that, but I feel like I do listen more. I mean, we could all, you know, open our ears more, but I have learned to listen more. But I feel like before I found knowledge of self or really got educated, I used to do a lot of talking because I love to converse. But, again, I listen more now. And another quote that hits home for me that relates to that, I feel like, is the man that knows something knows that he knows nothing at all. But yeah, that's it for now.
Ashe. Ashe. Excellent points. I think a lot of folks, you'll see that pay off big time, that listening, attentive listening. He talked about that as well, and like not just sitting there like, oh my God, would you stop talking? I'm waiting to talk. But I mean, really listening, paying attention to what the person has to say and being sincere about it, asking questions and what have you, showing that, you know, you appreciate what that person is sharing with you. I think that's something that especially non-white people, I think, really respond to that well, I think. Children, older victims, I think everybody tends to really appreciate that. I guess one thing I would throw out on the job, especially since this was kind of being talked about at the end of the program, I think this should work there as well in terms of just aiding you and being able to control the conversation. I know Mr. Fuller, he has a concept called compensatory conversation control. And you can use this really anytime, but I would think it would work on the job too. If you want to make sure that you don't get trapped just being asked a lot of questions and having to respond, make sure it's a conversation. Ask questions. Get them talking about themselves. That's one thing he talked about in this section. Man, people have egos. People enjoy talking about themselves, things that they have some expertise in, or at least think that they have some expertise in. If you can find that, I would say especially for white people, I mean, man, they are like racist man, racist woman, racist child. They are like the poster child for narcissism and ego and looking down on people, being arrogant. I think for white people, and I think sometimes that comes out on the program, you can use that to your advantage where you can get them talking about themselves, where that will stop them from asking you questions and you'll still be good. Like they won't be saying that you're aloof, because I think that was coming up. People saying that you don't want to be come across as being aloof or standoffish, like you're not really having contact with the white coworkers, where you can ask questions and you can be the one that's listening. So just make sure you get that in as well. Make sure you are not just chatting away, as it says, make sure you're not just chatting away about you and letting them hammer you with questions. Turn it into a dialogue. If they ask you something, answer their question. And then before you just answer and be silent, answer and then already be formulating a question that might somehow relate to what they asked you, or it doesn't have to, but be formulating a question. So bang, goes back to them. And then maybe you can even get two or three questions. So, you know, you won't have to talk for a while. Let's see, there was a lot of great information in this section, I thought. Other things I definitely want to touch, but there was also, I thought, some blatant racism in here, and you try to catch everything, which requires being mindful and really, you know, being on the ball. One portion that I thought was blatant racism, anytime that Abraham Lincoln is referenced, in my view, that's pretty much an act of racism, because when they talk about him, they're not talking about him sharing some of the racist jokes. They're not talking about him as, we need to get these niggas out of here. This should be a white man's country. Maybe we can send them back to Africa or something. They're not talking about Abraham Lincoln as a white supremacist racist. They talk about him as freer of dark people, squasher of slavery. I mean, it's just, it is the practice of racism, white supremacy, and there's a big chunk of that right in the middle. This is, well, I have an ebook version, so my page numbers will not correspond if you have the actual text. But it says, during the darkest, that's straight from the Word guy, during the darkest hours of the Civil War, Lincoln wrote to an old friend in Springfield, Illinois, asking him to come to Washington. Lincoln said he had some problems he wanted to discuss with him. The old neighbor called at the White House, and Lincoln talked to him for hours about the advisability of issuing a proclamation freeing the slaves. Lincoln went over all the arguments for and against such a move, and then read letters and newspaper articles, some denouncing him for not freeing the slaves, and others denouncing him for fear he was going to free them. After talking for hours, Lincoln shook hands with his old neighbor, said goodnight, and sent him back to Illinois without even asking for his opinion. Lincoln had done all the talking himself. That seemed to clarify in his mind. He seemed to feel easier after that talk, the old friend said. Lincoln hadn't wanted advice. He had wanted merely a friendly, sympathetic listener to whom he could unburden himself. That's what we all want when we are in trouble. That is frequently all the irritated customer wants, and the dissatisfied employee or the hurt friend. Now, in my view, excellent information. Absolutely correct, in my view. Many times, frequently, I even employ this on the program, this lesson, because I think it's hugely important. Sometimes if I'm talking to a victim of racism and they don't agree, right? Like they'll say something like white people are ignorant. That's the problem. Sometimes if I'm talking to a non-white person, I will just listen, particularly if I see that they are emotional about this, or this is something that they are really excited about, where they are being louder, they are breathing a little more quickly. You can just tell they're a little more excited, a little more emotional. I will not respond. I don't feel the need to always announce that I don't agree with something that has been said. I have found that that is also works really, really well. And it's not about hiding what you think. It's not about being deceptive. It's just about particularly, well, I would say really with anybody, white person or victim of racism, you don't always need to announce your view. Many times it will just be an argument, because frequently, regardless of how well you articulate your position, how logical it is, it could be 1,000% accurate. Frequently, racists and victims of racism don't care. I think we all can attest to that. So sometimes I think it's good to just gauge when, hey, I don't really need to. This person doesn't agree. We don't have the same opinion. No problem. And I don't even need to announce that. Like, they can just make their point of view and you can just acknowledge that you've heard them. Like, I have seen it. I mean, it's been incredible. I've had some tense conversations where, you know, we did not agree and it was very apparent that neither side was going to change. And just finding whatever point where you've got to, you say, well, I have clearly articulated myself. This person's not going to change their view. You know, we could argue about this for the next 20 years. Or I can just, hey, I will let them say whatever they need to say. If this is a victim, let them say whatever they need to say. Acknowledge that I've heard them and we can move forward. I found that that can work really well. It's awesome strategy. But with the Lincoln portion, just tying this great advice to a racist, major, in my view, major act of racism, white supremacy, and white people do this sort of thing consciously on a regular basis, in my opinion, where they make their like ancestors, their racist ancestors, they will make sure that they remain revered and worshipped around the world as just exemplary examples of justice and civil behavior and humanity, and nothing could be further from the truth. Even though this is a great illustration, it's tied to a racist. I'll mute my line, check, see if anybody else has anything they want to share.
Something else that stuck out for me was when they were talking about the quote-unquote poor Dutch boy, which I heard poor white boy, but anyway, that wrote the famous people and was invited and welcomed to their homes. I was just like, okay, trying to imagine a non-white person in the same predicament, and I just couldn't. I couldn't imagine them being even replied to. And I feel like if they were replied to, they would probably get one of those automated letters or messages with the stamp signatures, because I've gotten plenty of those, but never a personal reply or personal correspondence. So, yeah, talking about that poor Dutch boy or whatever they were talking about. That stuck out as well.
Yeah, that reminded me. I think it might have been the first session that we did on this book. One of the callers, he said that because the author, Dale Carnegie, he had went and he did the same thing as this Dutch white boy. He went and talked to all of these well-known, powerful white people, and the caller was saying that he didn't think, because of the system of white supremacy, he didn't think a non-white person would have access to those people to get that sort of information. And that was true when this book was published in 1936, and it's true now, 2013. Yeah, there were a couple points, I thought, of just really blatant racism. I think right at the beginning of the audio book this week, when he's talking, I think this is his own little anecdote, when he talks about being with the woman and she's traveled to Africa, and he said he'd only been there briefly, and he's asking her to tell me more about your visit. And he says, as we sat on the sofa, she remarked that she and her husband had recently returned from a trip to Africa. Africa, I exclaimed. How interesting. I've always wanted to see Africa, but I never got there except for a 24-hour stay once in Algiers. Tell me, did you visit the big game country? Yes? How fortunate. I envy you. Do tell me about Africa. And he says she goes on talking about this for 45 minutes and never asked in. Just goes on and on and on. I mean, pause number one, since I think our guest that was just on the program was saying that white people are ignorant about black people, that's the problem. And this book was published in 1936. So I will say again, white people are not ignorant about black people or racism. They have made it their business to do this, to go and have all sorts of little field trips and excursions all over the continent of Africa and the rest of the planet. They're not ignorant. But yeah, just the association Africa, this mythical jungle land where you can go and hunt some exotic place, and the sexual, I think, is implied as well. Battle for Algiers popped in my head as well. Anyone wants to check that out? I think there was one more that I thought was just blatant racism. This is after the Lincoln passage. This is at the close before they go to chapter 5. It says, remember that the people you are talking to are 800 times more interested in themselves and their wants and problems than they are in you and your problems. And I could not agree with that more. A person's toothache means more to that person than a famine in China, which kills a million people. A boil on one's neck interests one more than 40 earthquakes in Africa. I thought both of those, that is the same pattern. It reminded me of the guest that we had on, the two racist suspects from the area of the world known as Germany. And it talked about the white supremacy in these quote unquote white charity organizations, where they always get to image dark people as being impoverished and starving and with no limbs and drowning in AIDS and Ebola and Middle Eastern respiratory syndrome and anything else that they've cooked up. And just talking about how this is just more racism, just getting that image in people's mind. Like, that's what you associate dark people with, is catastrophe and calamity and, oh my gosh, just the worst imaginable bad things. And that's another example right there. China, Africa, both areas of the world that are associated with darker people, non-white people, and earthquakes and famine. That's what we're supposed to think of when we think of these people. Checking to see if there anything else that stands out. I know we had our little disruption. I won't say a little, pretty significant disruption. Do see folks on the line. Encourage participation. Don't want to have a lot of spectators, but if folks don't have anything to share at this point, I'll see if I have other things I'd like to pick out, and then we'll check maybe about 10 minutes or so. Then we'll get started with the second segment, unless anyone has anything they would like to share. Let's see. Other things that stood out in this segment. Interest, really thinking of how that can be applied to racism. I think I've heard that from many victims, talking about with regards to getting other non-white people to see the value why or how this is connected to their own personal interest to study racism, white supremacy, to take it seriously. That is something we should all be thinking about. How can we make this personally relevant and interesting to other non-white people so that more of us will, you know, use our time and energy to try to solve this problem? See, we had two other folks that dialed in. The person, I think this is our caller in Alabama, and the caller at 9325. Your two lines should be open.
I think when I was listening to the reader, whoever the publisher is of the book, I'm not sure about that, but when he was saying something about you should take a genuine interest and what, you know, people are talking about, you know what I'm saying, if you want to, you know, like be a good conversationalist or whatever like that, that's kind of something I find hard sometimes. It's like, I'm kind of guilty of what he's saying. Well, I'm not kind of guilty. I'm all the way guilty. But yeah, I probably talk about what I like more, you know, and then when they get to talking, I'm like halfway interested, but I'm like, all right, I'm ready for you to shut up so I can go on about what I was talking about in the first place. You know, and I know that's rude, you see what I'm saying, but what type of way would you find a genuine interest in some of you not genuinely interested in what they're talking about? You see what I'm saying? Like, do you have to make yourself interested in some or what?
That is a good question. I know for me, like, I have to pick a subject that I really am averse to, like Real Housewives. That's not, I could not, you know, fake interest in hearing about that too much. I can maybe do like 5 minutes, but I wouldn't have a lot of patience for that. And I think if people are talking about things that you really aren't interested in, whatever the subject matter happens to be, I would try to have enough, if it's something that, you know, is of interest to them, I would have a little bit of patience, like where you can give them a small window to get that out, because I do think that's important. But so that it's not something that they're talking about for, you know, the next hour, I would be trying to.
So basically, I would say, by the way you explained it, I would say probably listen, you know, talk about, like you said, Real Housewives of Atlanta or whatever like that, and probably hear something that they said in that that remind you of another subject and probably throw that in there or something like that.
That would work. That would be great. You know, if you can kind of make it a tangent so there is some relationship, or you can just ask a question. If it's something, it's been my interest that most people, if you spend some time with them, it won't just be one thing. They generally will have, you know, two or three things that they're interested in. So if once they start talking about that, you give them, you know, maybe 2 minutes and to get whatever they got to get off on that. All right. That was on. Right. Man, then bang, switch up and make your transition to whatever you want to ask.
Okay, all right. Well, I appreciate it, man. I'm going to mute my line.
9325, you should be with us as well.
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, just listening to the caller from Alabama, in this same portion of the book, it says that a patient, sympathetic listener who will be silent even when there's an irate fault finder diluting like a king cobra spewing poison out of his system, or you can look at that as something you're not interested in. If you just remain silent for a certain period of time until they play themselves out, then you have the opportunity to maybe even change the subject. That's my view on that. But one thing I wanted to bring up was Mrs. Henrietta Douglas, who had taken a course and how to influence, win friends and influence people. She went into the clothing store and she had purchased a coat. And there was some defect with the coat. But when she went back to bring that up to the owners of the store, she was met with some negative feedback, like it was a special sale and that all of the sales were final. So there was nothing they could do with her. They even suggested that she sew the coat up herself. That reminds me of a lot of non-white people. When we feel like we've been slighted or done wrong in some type of way, we may even bring this up. But a lot of times we don't ask for the manager. You know, don't always accept the first thing that someone tells you. They are just trying to get you out of the way, or they may think they're doing the store, you know, some good turn. But if a lot of times, if you ask to see the manager or someone that's in charge, and you bring your discrepancy up to someone that has the power to actually do something, you know, we may get a lot of our grievances heard, and we may even do some good for the company as far as losing customers on, say, the manager didn't know that the salespeople were turning down customers that had grievances. Then you brought it to their attention, and they can spend more time on that, maybe customer service. But just more non-white people not accepting, you know, second-class treatment, and then insisting that their grievances is heard, and even going up the chain of command. That's my little commentary. Thank you.
Right on. Appreciate that, as well as the remembering the section in the book that again went to that being a patient listener. And I know it can be tough. I know I can speak for myself. I know for me, if we're talking about victims of racism, non-white people, if they, you know, are just talking about stuff that's not constructive, like it is a challenge for me. I don't know about anybody else, but I know that can be a challenge for me to just be a patient listener when people are not really talking about anything constructive. But you know, if they're folks that if they're victims that you know you're going to be around, either on the job or if they're family members, for whatever reason, you know you're going to have some contact with these folks, really make an effort. You know, kind of be telling yourself, I'm going to be patient. I'm going to resist the urge to hop in and say something. You know, I'm really going to make an effort to listen and try to engage them on subject matter where I know they have some interest. And I would say there should be a payoff on that, because I wouldn't care what the subject is. There's going to be some racism, like whatever their interest, whatever things that they, you know, are into. If they're into finances and the stock market, business, racism is going to be there. If they're in the sports, the racism is going to be there. If they are into filmmaking, the racism is going to be there. I mean, it doesn't matter what their interest is. I suspect that some sooner or later you will get an opportunity to talk about racism in that specific field or area. So, yeah, always patient listening. I'm always a big supporter of patient listening and resisting the urge to interrupt, too, I think is important. Let's see. Anybody else have anything else folks want to get out before we get to segment number two? right, assume everybody was good. Folks that did not participate during the first portion, if you had something that stood out, just write it down, make a little note, and we will make sure we have time to discuss when the second audio clip concludes. Let's see, I will look. They have at least the ebook version that I have, they have a little segment. I don't really know what you call it, like important notes, I guess that's what they titled it. But it has some of the important, like a bullet point of important points, the most important points that you should be taking away from each section of the book. And we haven't got very far. Well, I guess we're about halfway through the book. I guess they have more finer detailed points as we get along. But we're about halfway through the book, but we've only done about four of these points so far. It looks like there are quite a few left that we haven't got to. But the ones that we have touched on so far, just a quick recap. First one is fundamental techniques in handling people. There are three. Number one, don't criticize. And they have that one highlighted. First one up, don't criticize. I will be saying that repeatedly until we conclude this book. This only applies to non-white people, of course. That should be taken for granted. I think I've been saying that pretty explicitly. Only applies to non-white people. Don't criticize. Resist the urge to criticize. Number two, give honest and sincere appreciation. Number three, arouse in the other person an eager want. Okay. Next is six ways to make people like you. I think we've only done one of these, so I will stop with the first one. So I think that's what I'm saying. We haven't really got very far. Oh, wait a minute. We did get some of these. I take that back. We have got. Sorry. Number one, become genuinely interested in other people. Number two, smile. Number three, remember a person's name. That's another one that they got highlighted. Number four, be a good listener. Encourage others to talk about themselves. Number five, talk in terms of the other person's interest. Stop right there. We're about to pick up, I think, at least two of these in the next little audio segment. Again, this is Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People. Oh, other person, since they did get their hand up, I'll go ahead and take their call before we get to the second caller at 5146. 5146, did you have something you wanted to get in?
Yeah, I was wondering that point about how to remember people's names. I never can have it in my life. I've ever been able to do that. Any more tips on that?
That's one that I struggle with as well, to remember people's names. And just for me, trying to get out of it, I try to get in a habit of calling people by their name more frequently. That way, I either know that I have it or I know that I don't have it, so that I can just ask. And since I know that it's important to me, if I fail, I just go ahead and ask. I apologize and just, you know, apologize that I did forget and ask for their name. Most of the time, if you apologize and ask again, people tend to be pretty good. But just being in the habit of trying to say the person's name frequently, like when I'm first meeting them, I'll try and be saying it over and over again, at least two or three times as I'm talking to them. Kind of when they were standing there, the person said they would go and they would write it down. That way they're seeing it, they're writing it, and then they would rip the paper up so they're hearing it. If I at least I'm saying it out loud, I'm saying it, I'm hearing myself saying it, and I'm associating hearing it with that person's face. I'm trying to think. Yeah, that's one I struggle with too. If I learn any better techniques, I'll share.
Thank you.
Anybody else on the line have techniques for remembering names?
I have one technique that I use. When I hear a person's name, I think of someone that I may have known with a similar name or the same name. And I may ask them, you know, some questions about their name or if they have any relatives from that particular area that I remember a person with a similar name. And then it generally draws a conversation. We talk a little bit about, you know, the name and the area that his people was from or whatever, and a small discussion about it. And then by the time that's over, you know, you can associate something with the person's name. That seemed to help me out. I'm pretty good on remembering people's names. But can I tell a quick story? Once I went to a job interview, and the guy's name was Buffinger, but it was spelled like Bowfinger. And so during the interview, I took the time to find out the correct pronunciation of his name. And I think that single thing won me the job just by being able to pronounce the guy's name correctly and not call him Mr. Bowfinger instead of Mr. Buffinger. Needless to say, I was fired from that job because of a racist slur that his son used. He used the word nigger rig in my presence and then apologized to me. And when I asked him why did he apologize to me, he couldn't answer the question. And he told his father that I said it was okay if he called me a nigger. And so after we went through a long, drawn-out discussion about that, I was let go a few days after that. But I just thought I'd share that story about pronouncing the guy's name correctly.
Thank you. It's a very thank you, Bob.
You can go ahead. Sorry.
No, I'm done. Thank you very much.
I apologize for interjecting. I was just gonna say a way to remember a name would be, like I know. Okay, like for instance, back in high school, so like a while ago. I took like a med tech class because initially when I went to college, I was in pre-med. And the way that we learned terms was to relate it to something. So, I mean, it goes, I guess it's kind of touching on what the other caller said about relating it to someone you know, but you could also use like adjectives that also describe that person, either have it rhyme or start with the same letter of their name. And it's so bad I can't even think of an example right now, but that'll be a way to remember a name. Buff Bob or Beautiful Betty or, I don't know, something like that. Just think of something, an adjective or a characteristic that describes that person that either rhymes with or begins with the same letter of their name. So I don't know. Yeah, it's kind of coupling their looks or their attributes or whatever with their name so that you can remember it.
I guess my major problem is I deal with a lot of white people, and I just can't recognize them. I can't recognize them from one minute to the next.
I feel like I've heard white people give out tips on that, like someone that would be more with saying and our male caller, where they have somewhere, I would ask some of the white people that you work with, or just white people, period. I would ask them if they have any tips on that. That's one thing that I found. I was telling one of our listeners, Pumpkin, if folks remember Mr. Flaherty, Colin Flaherty, he did White Girl Bleed a lot. And I was trying to get his book, and I said I couldn't pay for it because he had all that racist stuff in there about, you know, black people raping and killing white people and everything else. And we searched and searched and tried to get a free copy. Couldn't find it. And finally, said, I'll just ask Mr. Flyer to see if we can get it that way. And lo and behold, we did. And I said, this is another reminder. I have no problem asking white people for information. I found that a lot of times white people, as in the book, will have a lot of great little tips and things like that. So I would just, you know, ask some of the white people that you're, this could be for anybody out there, any of the white people that you're around. Like, have you heard any good tips, effective tips for remembering names? See what they say. They might come up with one that works. And then you can share with us if they give you one.
Thanks. I'll try it again. I just have a real hard time with it. It's just pitiful. Thanks a lot, though.
I'm bad at that, too. I think it's important.
Yes, maybe I'm just, you know, one of the problems I think associated with that is having some interest. It's difficult to come up with most of the time. Thank you.
I feel you. That would definitely be more childlike, that giving us that extra information about this is white people on the job. Like, that would make it a lot more challenging for me, having these just random white people that you work with that you don't have any interest in chatting with beyond the job and don't know anything about. That would be a bit more challenging for me too. Yeah, I'll check on that and make that a homework assignment. Help on names. Is there anything else folks wanted to get in before we get to the second audio segment? Anything else? Right on. I was going to say the anecdote that our male caller shared with us before we get to segment number two. It reminded me, I don't know if I shared this last week, but they were saying if you can learn from the other person's perspective, what are their interests? And it was reminding me, Serena Williams, she went, I think he shared an example of one of the people, they traveled to a different place and he knew a little bit of the language and that impressed the people so much because he took an interest in them. Serena Williams, victim of racism, she won the French Open. She spoke French at the trophy presentation. And I was like, you know, that's another illustration. Like, hey, you've shown some interest in learning their language and their culture and blah, blah, blah. You're still a victim of racism. You can do all this stuff. And you should use a lot of these techniques because they will work. But, hey, we are in a system of racism. Don't think that, you know, any of these are going to make you immune from being terrorized, as our male caller shared. Even when you remember their name, they remember yours. And yours, unfortunately, ours is nigger. Segment number two, Dale Carnegie. How to win friends and influence people. Context of white supremacy.
Chapter 6. How to make people like you instantly. I was waiting in line to register a letter at the post office at 33rd Street and 8th Avenue in New York. I noticed that the clerk appeared to be bored with the job, weighing envelopes, handing out stamps, making change, issuing receipts, the same monotonous grind year after year. So I said to myself, I'm going to try to make that clerk like me. Obviously, to make him like me, I must say something nice, and not about myself, but about him. So I asked myself, what is there about him that I can honestly admire? That is sometimes a hard question to answer, especially with strangers. But in this case, it happened to be easy. I instantly saw something I admired no end. So while he was weighing my envelope, I remarked with enthusiasm, I certainly wish I had your head of hair. He looked up, half startled, his face beaming with smiles. Well, it isn't as good as it used to be, he said modestly. I assured him that although it might have lost some of its pristine glory, nevertheless it was still magnificent. He was immensely pleased. We carried on a pleasant little conversation, and the last thing he said to me was, many people have admired my hair. I'll bet that person went out to lunch that day, walking on air. I'll bet he went home that night and told his wife about it. I'll bet he looked in the mirror and said, it is a beautiful head of hair. I told this story once in public, and a man asked me afterward, what did you want to get out of him? What was I trying to get out of him? If we are so contemptibly selfish that we can't radiate a little happiness and pass on a bit of honest appreciation without trying to get something out of the other person in return, if our souls are no bigger than sour crabapples, we shall meet with the failure we so richly deserve. Oh, yes, I did want something out of that chap. I wanted something priceless, and I got it. I got the feeling that I had done something for him without his being able to do anything whatever in return for me. Now, that's a feeling that flows and sings in your memory long after the incident is past. There's one all-important law of human conduct. If we obey that law, we shall almost never get into trouble. In fact, that law, if obeyed, will bring us countless friends and constant happiness. But the very instant we break the law, we shall get into endless trouble. The law is this: always make the other person feel important. John Dewey, as we have already noted, said that the desire to be important is the deepest urge in human nature. And William James said, the deepest principle in human nature is the craving to be appreciated. As I have already pointed out, it is this urge that differentiates us from the animals. It is this urge that has been responsible for civilization itself. Philosophers have been speculating on the rules of human relationships for thousands of years, and out of all that speculation, there has evolved only one important precept. It is not new. It is as old as history. Zoroaster taught it to his followers in Persia 2,500 years ago. Confucius preached it in China 24 centuries ago. Lao Tse, the founder of Taoism, taught it to his disciples in the Valley of the Han. Buddha preached it on the bank of the Holy Ganges 500 years before Christ. The sacred books of Hinduism taught it 1,000 years before that. Jesus taught it among the stony hills of Judea 19 centuries ago. Jesus summed it up in one thought, probably the most important rule in the world: do unto others as you would have others do unto you. You want the approval of those with whom you come in contact. You want recognition of your true worth. You want a feeling that you are important in your little world. You don't want to listen to cheap, insincere flattery, but you do crave sincere appreciation. You want your friends and associates to be, as Charles Schwab put it, hearty in their approbation and lavish in their praise. All of us want that. So let's obey the golden rule and give unto others what we would have others give unto us. How? When? Where? The answer is all the time, everywhere. David G. Smith of Eau Claire, Wisconsin, told one of our classes how he handled a delicate situation when he was asked to take charge of the refreshment booth at a charity concert. The night of the concert, I arrived at the park and found two elderly ladies in a very bad humor standing next to the refreshment stand. Apparently, each thought that she was in charge of this project. As I stood there pondering what to do, one of the members of the sponsoring committee appeared and handed me a cash box and thanked me for taking over the project. She introduced Rose and Jane as my helpers and then ran off. A great silence ensued, and realizing that the cash box was a symbol of authority of sorts, I gave the box to Rose and explained that I might not be able to keep the money straight and that if she took care of it, I'd feel better. I then suggested to Jane that she show two teenagers who'd been assigned to refreshments how to operate the soda machine, and I asked her to be responsible for that part of the project. The evening was very enjoyable, with Rose happily counting the money, Jane supervising the teenagers, and me enjoying the concert. You don't have to wait until you're ambassador to France or chairman of the clambake committee of your lodge before you use this philosophy of appreciation. You can work magic with it almost every day. If, for example, the waitress brings us mashed potatoes when we have ordered French fries, let's say, "I'm sorry to trouble you, but I prefer French fried." She'll probably reply, "No trouble at all," and will be glad to change the potatoes because we have shown respect for her. Little phrases such as, "I'm sorry to trouble you," "Would you be so kind?" "Won't you please?" "Would you mind?" "Thank you." Little courtesies like these oil the cogs of the monotonous grind of everyday life, and incidentally, they're the hallmarks of good breeding. Let's take another illustration. Hall Caine's novels, The Christian, The Deemster, The Manxman, among them, were all bestsellers in the early part of this century. Millions of people read his novels, countless millions. He was the son of a blacksmith. He never had more than 8 years of schooling in his life, yet when he died, he was the richest literary man of his time. The story goes like this. Hall Caine loved sonnets and ballads, so he devoured all of Dante Gabriel Rossetti's poetry. He even wrote a lecture chanting the praises of Rossetti's artistic achievement and sent a copy to Rossetti himself. Rossetti was delighted. "Any young man who has such an exalted opinion of my ability," Rossetti probably said to himself, "must be brilliant." So Rossetti invited this blacksmith's son to come to London and act as his secretary. That was the turning point in Hall Caine's life, for in his new position he met the literary artists of the day. Profiting by their advice and inspired by their encouragement, he launched upon a career that emblazoned his name across the sky. His home, Greba Castle on the Isle of Man, became a mecca for tourists from the far corners of the world, and he left a multi-million-dollar estate. Yet who knows, he might have died poor and unknown had he not written an essay expressing his admiration for a famous man. Such is the power, the stupendous power, of sincere, heartfelt appreciation. Rossetti considered himself important. That is not strange. Almost everyone considers himself important, very important. The life of many a person could probably be changed if only someone would make him feel important. Ronald J. Rowland, who is one of the instructors of our course in California, is also a teacher of arts and crafts. He wrote to us about a student named Chris in his beginning crafts class. Chris was a very quiet, shy boy, lacking in self-confidence, the kind of student that often does not receive the attention he deserves. I also teach an advanced class that had grown to be somewhat of a status symbol and a privilege for a student to have earned the right to be in it. On Wednesday, Chris was diligently working at his desk. I really felt there was a hidden fire deep inside him. I asked Chris if he'd like to be in the advanced class. How I wish I could express the look in Chris's face, the emotions in that shy 14-year-old boy trying to hold back his tears. "Who, me, Mr. Rowland? Am I good enough?" "Yes, Chris, you're good enough." I had to leave at that point because tears were coming to my eyes. As Chris walked out of the class that day, seemingly 2 inches taller, he looked at me with bright blue eyes and said in a positive voice, "Thank you, Mr. Rowland." Chris taught me a lesson I will never forget. Our deep desire to feel important. To help me never forget this rule, I made a sign which reads, "You are important." This sign hangs in the front of the classroom for all to see, and to remind me that each student I face is equally important. The unvarnished truth is that almost all the people you meet feel themselves superior to you in some way, and a sure way to their hearts is to let them realize in some subtle way that you recognize their importance and recognize it sincerely. Remember what Emerson said, "Every man I meet is my superior in some way. In that, I learn of him." And the pathetic part of it is that frequently those who have the least justification for a feeling of achievement bolster up their egos by a show of tumult and conceit which is truly nauseating. As Shakespeare put it, "Man, proud man, dressed in a little brief authority, plays such fantastic tricks before high heaven as make the angels weep." I'm going to tell you how business people in my own courses have applied these principles with remarkable results. Let's take the case of a Connecticut attorney. Because of his relatives, he prefers not to have his name mentioned. Shortly after joining the course, Mr. R. drove to Long Island with his wife to visit some of her relatives. She left him to chat with an old aunt of hers, and then rushed off by herself to visit some of the younger relatives. Since he soon had to give a speech, professionally, on how he applied the principles of appreciation, he thought he would gain some worthwhile experience talking with the elderly lady. So he looked around the house to see what he could honestly admire. This house was built about 1890, wasn't it? He inquired. Yes, she replied. That's precisely the year it was built. It reminds me of the house I was born in, he said. It's beautiful, well-built, roomy. You know, they don't build houses like this anymore. You're right, the old lady agreed. The young folks nowadays don't care for beautiful homes. All they want is a small apartment, and then they go off gadding about in their automobiles. This is a dream house, she said, in a voice vibrating with tender memories. This house was built with love. My husband and I dreamed about it for years before we built it. We didn't have an architect. We planned it all ourselves. She showed Mr. R. about the house, and he expressed his hearty admiration for the beautiful treasures she'd picked up in her travels and cherished over a lifetime. Paisley shawls, an old English tea set, Wedgwood china, French beds and chairs, Italian paintings and silk draperies that had once hung in a French chateau. After showing Mr. R. through the house, she took him out to the garage. There, jacked up on blocks, was a Packard car in mint condition. "My husband bought that car for me shortly before he passed on," she said softly. "I have never ridden in it since his death. You appreciate nice things, and I'm going to give this car to you."
"Why, Auntie," he said, "you overwhelm me. I appreciate your generosity, of course, but I couldn't possibly accept it. I'm not even a relative of yours. I have a new car, and you have many relatives that would like to have that Packard."
"Relatives?" she exclaimed. "Yes, I had relatives who were just waiting till I die so they can get that car, but they are not going to get it."
"If you don't want to give it to them, you could very easily sell it to a second-hand dealer," he told her.
"Sell it?" she cried. "Do you think I would sell this car? Do you think I could stand to see strangers riding up and down the street in that car? That car that my husband bought for me? I wouldn't dream of selling it. I'm going to give it to you. You appreciate beautiful things."
He tried to get out of accepting the car, but he couldn't without hurting her feelings. This lady, left all alone in the big house with her Paisley shawls, her French antiques, and her memories, was starving for a little recognition. She had once been young and beautiful and sought after. She had once built a house warm with love and had collected things from all over Europe to make it beautiful. Now, in the isolated loneliness of old age, she craved a little human warmth, a little genuine appreciation, and no one gave it to her. And when she found it, like a spring in a desert, her gratitude couldn't adequately express itself with anything less than the gift of her cherished Packard. Let's take another case. Donald M. McMahon, who was superintendent of Lewis and Valentine, nurserymen and landscape architects in Rye, New York, related this incident. "Shortly after I attended the talk on how to win friends and influence people, I was landscaping the estate of a famous attorney. The owner came out to give me a few instructions about where he wished to plant a mass of rhododendrons and azaleas. I said, 'Judge, you have a lovely hobby. I've been admiring your beautiful dogs. I understand you win a lot of blue ribbons every year at the show in Madison Square Garden.' And the effect of this little expression of appreciation was striking. 'Yes,' the judge replied, 'I do have a lot of fun with my dogs. Would you like to see my kennel?' And he spent almost an hour showing me his dogs and the prizes they'd won. He even brought out their pedigrees and explained about the bloodlines responsible for such beauty and intelligence. Finally, turning to me, he asked, 'Do you have any small children?' 'Well, yes, I do,' I replied. 'I have a son.' 'Well, wouldn't he like a puppy?' the judge inquired. 'Well, yes, he'd be tickled pink.' 'All right, I'm going to give him one,' the judge announced. He started to tell me how to feed the puppy. Then he paused. 'You'll forget if I tell you. I'll write it out.' So the judge went in the house, typed out the pedigree and feeding instructions, and gave me a puppy worth several $100 and an hour and 15 minutes of his valuable time, largely because I'd expressed my honest admiration for his hobby and achievements. George Eastman of Kodak fame invented the transparent film that made motion pictures possible, amassed a fortune of $100 million, and made himself one of the most famous businessmen on earth. Yet in spite of all these tremendous accomplishments, he craved little recognitions, even as you and I. To illustrate,
When Eastman was building the Eastman School of Music and also Kilbourne Hall in Rochester, James Adamson, then president of the Superior Seating Company of New York, wanted to get the order to supply the theater chairs for these buildings. Phoning the architect, Mr. Adamson made an appointment to see Mr. Eastman in Rochester. When Adamson arrived, the architect said, "I know you want to get this order, but I can tell you right now that you won't stand a ghost of a show if you take more than 5 minutes of George Eastman's time. He's a strict disciplinarian. He's very busy, so tell your story quickly and get out." Adamson was prepared to do just that. And when he was ushered into the room, he saw Mr. Eastman bending over a pile of papers at his desk. And presently, Mr. Eastman looked up, removed his glasses, and walked toward the architect and Mr. Adamson, saying, "Good morning, gentlemen. What can I do for you?" And the architect introduced them, and then Mr. Adamson said, "While we've been waiting for you, Mr. Eastman, I've been admiring your office. I wouldn't mind working in a room like this myself. I'm in the interior woodworking business, and I never saw a more beautiful office in all my life." And George Eastman replied, "You remind me of something I had almost forgotten. It is beautiful, isn't it? I enjoyed it a great deal when it was first built, but I come down here now with a lot of other things on my mind and sometimes don't even see the room for weeks at a time." Adamson walked over and rubbed his hand across a panel. "And this is English oak, isn't it? A little different texture from Italian oak." "Yes," Eastman replied. "Imported English oak. It was selected for me by a friend who specializes in fine woods." And then Eastman showed him about the room, commenting on the proportions, the coloring, the hand carving, and other effects he'd helped to plan and execute. While drifting about the room, admiring the woodwork, they paused before a window, and George Eastman, in his modest, soft-spoken way, pointed out some of the institutions through which he was trying to help humanity: the University of Rochester, the General Hospital, the Homeopathic Hospital, the Friendly Home, the Children's Hospital. Mr. Adamson congratulated him warmly on the idealistic way he was using his wealth to alleviate the sufferings of humanity. Presently, George Eastman unlocked a glass case and pulled out the first camera he had ever owned, an invention he had bought from an Englishman. Adamson questioned him at length about his early struggles to get started in business. Mr. Eastman spoke with real feeling about the poverty of his childhood, telling how his widowed mother had kept a boarding house while he clerked in an insurance office. The terror of poverty haunted him day and night, and he resolved to make enough money so that his mother wouldn't have to work. Mr. Adamson drew him out with further questions and listened, absorbed, while he related the story of his experiments with dry photographic plates. He told how he had worked in an office all day and sometimes experimented all night, taking only brief naps while the chemicals were working, sometimes working and sleeping in his clothes for 72 hours at a stretch. James Adamson had been ushered into Eastman's office at 10:15 and had been warned that he must not take more than 5 minutes, but an hour had passed, and then 2 hours passed, and they were still talking. Finally, George Eastman turned to Adamson and said, "The last time I was in Japan, I bought some chairs, brought them home and put them on my sun porch, but the sun peeled the paint, so I went downtown the other day and bought some paint and painted the chairs myself. Wouldn't you like to see what sort of a job I can do painting chairs? All right, come up to my home and have lunch with me, and I'll show you." The order for the seats amounted to $90,000. Now, who do you suppose got the order? James Adamson or one of his competitors? From the time of this story until Mr. Eastman's death, he and James Adamson were close friends. Claude Marais, a restaurant owner in Rouen, France, used this principle and saved his restaurant the loss of a key employee. This woman had been in his employ for 5 years and was a vital link between Monsieur Marais and his staff of 21 people. He was shocked to receive a registered letter from her advising him of her resignation. Monsieur Marais reported, "I was very surprised and even more disappointed because I was under the impression that I had been fair to her and receptive to her needs. Inasmuch as she was a friend as well as an employee, I probably had taken her too much for granted.
and maybe was even more demanding of her than of other employees. I could not, of course, accept this resignation without some explanation. I took her aside and said, "Paulette, you must understand that I cannot accept your resignation. You mean a great deal to me and to this company, and you are as important to the success of this restaurant as I am." I repeated this in front of the entire staff and invited her to my home and reiterated my confidence in her with my family present. Paulette withdrew her resignation, and today I can rely on her as never before. I frequently reinforce this by expressing my appreciation for what she does and showing her how important she is to me and to the restaurant. "Talk to people about themselves," said Disraeli, one of the shrewdest men who ever ruled the British Empire. "Talk to people about themselves, and they will listen for hours." Principle 6. Make the other person feel important, and do it sincerely. In a nutshell, 6 ways to make people like you. Principle 1. Become genuinely interested in other people. Principle 2. Smile. Principle 3. Remember that a person's name is to that person the sweetest and most important sound in any language. Principle 4. Be a good listener. Encourage others to talk about themselves. Principle 5. Talk in terms of the other person's interests. Principle 6. Make the other person feel important and do it sincerely. Part 3. How to Win People to Your Way of Thinking. Chapter 1. You Can't Win an Argument. Shortly after the close of World War I, I learned an invaluable lesson one night in London. I was manager at the time for Sir Ross Smith. During the war, Sir Ross had been the Australian ace out in Palestine, and shortly after peace was declared, he astonished the world by flying halfway round it in 30 days. No such feat had ever been attempted before. It created a tremendous sensation. The Australian government awarded him $50,000. The King of England knighted him, and for a while he was the most talked-about man under the Union Jack. I was attending a banquet one night given in Sir Ross's honor, and during the dinner, the man sitting next to me told a humorous story which hinged on the quotation, "There's a divinity that shapes our ends, rough-hew them how we will." And the raconteur mentioned that the quotation was from the Bible. He was wrong, I knew that. I knew it positively. There couldn't be the slightest doubt about it. And so, to get a feeling of importance and display my superiority, I appointed myself an unsolicited and unwelcome committee of one to correct him. He stuck to his guns. "What? From Shakespeare? Impossible. Absurd. That quotation was from the Bible, and he knew it." The storyteller was sitting on my right, and Frank Gammond, an old friend of mine, was seated at my left. Mr. Gammond had devoted years to the study of Shakespeare, so the storyteller and I agreed to submit the question to Mr. Gammond. Mr. Gammond listened. He kicked me under the table and then said, "Dale, you're wrong. The gentleman is right. It is from the Bible." On our way home that night, I said to Mr. Gammond, "Frank, you know that quotation was from Shakespeare." "Yes, of course," he replied. "Hamlet, Act 5, Scene 2. But we were guests at a festive occasion, my dear Dale. Why prove to a man that he is wrong? Is that going to make him like you? Why not let him save his face? He didn't ask for your opinion. He didn't want it. Why argue with him? Always avoid the acute angle." The man who said that taught me a lesson I'll never forget. I'd not only made the storyteller uncomfortable, but it put my friend in an embarrassing situation. How much better it would have been had I not become argumentative. It was a sorely needed lesson, because I'd been an inveterate arguer. During my youth, I'd argued with my brother about everything under the Milky Way. When I went to college, I studied logic and argumentation and went in for debating contests. Talk about being from Missouri. I was born there. I had to be shown. Later, I taught debating and argumentation in New York. And once, I'm ashamed to admit, I plan to write a book on the subject. Since then, I have listened to, engaged in, and watched the effects of thousands of arguments. As a result of all this, I've come to the conclusion that there's only one way under high heaven to get the best of an argument, and that is to avoid it. Avoid it as you would avoid rattlesnakes and earthquakes. 9 times out of 10, an argument ends with each of the contestants more firmly convinced than ever that he is absolutely right. You can't win an argument. You can't, because if you lose it, you lose it, and if you win it, you lose it. Why? Well, suppose you triumph over the other man and shoot his argument full of holes and prove that he is non compos mentis. And then what? You will feel fine, but what about him? You've made him feel inferior. You've hurt his pride. He will resent your triumph. And a man convinced, against his will, is of the same opinion still. Years ago, Patrick J. O'Hare joined one of my classes. He had had little education, and how he loved a scrap. He had once been a chauffeur, and he came to me because he had been trying, without much success, to sell trucks. A little questioning brought out the fact that he was continually scrapping with and antagonizing the very people he was trying to do business with. If a prospect said anything derogatory about the trucks he was selling, Pat saw red and was right at the customer's throat. Pat won a lot of arguments in those days. As he said to me afterward, I often walked out of an office saying, I told that bird something. Sure, I'd told him something, but I hadn't sold him anything. My first problem was not to teach Patrick J. O'Hare to talk. My immediate task was to train him to refrain from talking and to avoid verbal fights. Mr. O'Hare became one of the star salesmen for the White Motor Company in New York. How did he do it? Now, here's his story in his own words. If I walk into a buyer's office now and he says, What, a white truck? They're no good. I wouldn't take one if he gave it to me. I'm going to buy the Hoosit truck. I say, The Hoosit's a good truck. If you buy the Hoosit, you'll never make a mistake. The Hoosits are made by a fine company and sold by good people. He's speechless then. There's no room for argument. If he says the Hoosit's the best, and I say, Sure it is, he has to stop. He can't keep on all afternoon saying, It's the best, when I'm agreeing with him. We then get off the subject of the Hoosit, and I begin to talk about the good points of the white truck. There was a time when a remark like his first one would have made me see scarlet and red and orange. I'd start arguing against the Hoosit, and the more I argued against it, the more my prospect argued in favor of it. The more he argued, the more he sold himself on my competitor's product. As I look back now, I wonder how I was ever able to sell anything. I lost years of my life in scrapping and arguing. I keep my mouth shut now. It pays. As wise old Ben Franklin used to say, if you argue and rankle and contradict, you may achieve a victory sometimes, but it will be an empty victory because you will never get your opponent's goodwill. So figure it out for yourself. Which would you rather have, an academic, theatrical victory or a person's goodwill? You can seldom have both. The Boston Transcript once printed this bit of significant doggerel. Here lies the body of William Jay, who died maintaining his right of way. He was right, dead right, as he sped along, but he's just as dead as if he were wrong. You may be right, dead right, as you speed along in your argument, but as far as changing another's mind is concerned, you will probably be just as futile as if you were wrong. Frederick S. Parsons, an income tax consultant, had been disputing and wrangling for an hour with a government tax inspector. An item of $9,000 was at stake. Mr. Parsons claimed that this $9,000 was in reality a bad debt, that it would never be collected, that it ought not to be taxed. Bad debt, my eye, retorted the inspector. It must be taxed. This inspector was cold, arrogant, and stubborn, Mr. Parsons said as he told the story of the class. Reason was wasted, and so were facts. The longer we argued, the more stubborn he became. So I decided to avoid argument, change the subject, and give him appreciation. I said, I suppose this is a very petty matter in comparison with the really important and difficult decisions you're required to make. I've made a study of taxation myself, but I've had to get my knowledge from books. You're getting yours from the firing line of experience. I sometimes wish I had a job like yours. It would teach me a lot. I meant every word I said. Well, the inspector straightened up in his chair, leaned back, and talked for a long time about his work, telling me of the clever frauds he had uncovered. His tone gradually became friendly, and presently he was telling me about his children. As he left, he advised me that he would consider my problem further and give me his decision in a few days. He called at my office 3 days later and informed me that he had decided to leave the tax return exactly as it was filed. Now, this tax inspector was demonstrating one of the most common of human frailties. He wanted a feeling of importance. And as long as Mr. Parsons argued with him, he got his feeling of importance by loudly asserting his authority. But as soon as his importance was admitted, and the argument stopped, and he was permitted to expand his ego, he became a sympathetic and kindly human being. Buddha said, "Hatred is never ended by hatred, but by love. And a misunderstanding is never ended by an argument, but by tact, diplomacy, conciliation, and a sympathetic desire to see the other person's viewpoint." Lincoln once reprimanded a young army officer for indulging in a violent controversy with an associate. "No man who is resolved to make the most of himself," said Lincoln, "can spare time for personal contention. Still less can he afford to take the consequences, including the vitiation of his temper and the loss of self-control. Yield larger things to which you show no more than equal rights, and yield lesser ones, though clearly your own. Better give our path to a dog than be bitten by him in contesting for the right. Even killing the dog would not cure the bite." In an article in Bits and Pieces, some suggestions are made on how to keep a disagreement from becoming an argument. Welcome the disagreement. Remember the slogan, "When two partners always agree, one of them is not necessary." If there is some point you haven't thought about, be thankful if it is brought to your attention. Perhaps this disagreement is your opportunity to be corrected before you make a serious mistake. Distrust your first instinctive impression. Our first natural reaction in a disagreeable situation is to be defensive. Be careful. Keep calm and watch out for your first reaction. It may be you at your worst, not your best. Control your temper. Remember, you can measure the size of a person by what makes him or her angry. Listen first. Give your opponents a chance to talk. Let them finish. Do not resist, defend, or debate. This only raises barriers. Try to build bridges of understanding. Don't build higher barriers of misunderstanding. Look for areas of agreement. When you have heard your opponents out, dwell first on the points and areas on which you agree. Be honest. Look for areas where you can admit error and say so. Apologize for your mistakes. It will help disarm your opponents and reduce defensiveness. Promise to think over your opponent's ideas and study them carefully, and mean it. Your opponents may be right. It is a lot easier at this stage to agree to think about their points than to move rapidly ahead and find yourself in a position where your opponents can say, "We tried to tell you, but you wouldn't listen." Thank your opponents sincerely for their interest. Anyone who takes the time to disagree with you is interested in the same things you are. Think of them as people who really want to help you, and you may turn your opponents into friends. Postpone action to give both sides time to think through the problem. Suggest that a new meeting be held later that day or the next day when all the facts may be brought to bear. In preparation for this meeting, ask yourself some hard questions. Could my opponents be right? Partly right? Is there truth or merit in their position or argument? Is my reaction one that will relieve the problem, or will it just relieve any frustration? Will my reaction drive my opponents further away or draw them closer to me? Will my reaction elevate the estimation good people have of me? Will I win or lose? What price will I have to pay if I win? If I am quiet about it, will the disagreement blow over? Is this difficult situation an opportunity for me? Opera tenor Jan Pierce, after he was married nearly 50 years, once said, "My wife and I made a pact a long time ago, and we've kept it no matter how angry we've grown with each other. When one yells, the other should listen, because when two people yell, there is no communication, just noise and bad vibrations." Principle 1. The only way to get the best of an argument is to avoid it.
Context of white supremacy. The number to dial is 760-569-7676, and the code is 564-943-POUND. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. The number again, 760-569-7676, and the code is 564-943-POUND. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Really enjoyed the second segment. I'll hit the phone lines before I do one passage. I had a lot of highlights, but one passage that I highlighted that I thought was just an exemplary summation of white people. He writes, The pathetic part of it is that frequently those who have the least justification for a feeling of achievement bolster up their egos by a show of tumult and conceit, which is truly nauseating. As Shakespeare put it, "Man, proud man, dressed in a little brief authority, plays such fantastic tricks before high heaven as make the angels weep." That is white people. Very well written, white people. The folks that dialed in, three, I think that's B-More. Caller at 5146 and caller at 9325. Your three lines are open. Anybody else, I'll get your hands as I see them.
The talk of white Jesus and I believe they said the quote or whatever, "Do unto others as you would have them do unto you." And I was just thinking, as Mr. Fuller says, racism, white supremacy is the biggest religion. And I feel like, of course, white people don't live up to that. Do unto others as you want them to do unto you. They don't follow that principle. And I feel like something that's reoccurring in this book is them talking about these so-called white people who are uneducated and coming from nothing and how they become rich and successful. And I was just thinking, under the system of white supremacy, it's 10 times harder for non-white people. But they, white people love to use other white people's stories as a reason to tell non-white people to stop using the race card and stop making excuses. Another thing, when they were talking about, when the reader was talking about the student, he asked to be in honors classes. I feel like he had to mention that he had, quote-unquote, bright blue eyes. And then he talked about the sign that he has in his classroom that says, "You are important." And it made me think briefly of the movie and the book, The Help. in that particular film, there's a segment where she says to the white child, a non-white, I'm going to just say nanny, says to the white child, you was smart, you was kind, you was important. Made me think of that. And then the contrast of how they compare predominantly white areas to predominantly non-white areas. Earlier in the book, they were talking about the famine, destruction, and calamity of China and Africa. But then they go on to say how this woman made her house beautiful by collecting things from Europe. So I guess we're supposed to associate beautiful things with Europe. And this is when they were talking about the woman wanting to give the car to the other white male or something like that. But, yeah, that's all for now.
And any of the other callers have any comments they want to get in?
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
As I was listening to the female caller give those points of interest, I thought about the part where the guy started talking about the man's pedigree dogs and the bloodlines and the beauty and the intelligence. And he asked him if he had a son. And he said, would he like a puppy? And he said he'd be tickle pink. And I just thought that was, you know, those phrases, no non-white person should be using those type phrases. That's for sure. But I think that this book, the points that he gives out are very good. Like one of the callers pointed out before, if you can look past a lot of this blatant racist, you know, ideas that he's, the way he's coming from, you can get some real gems out of here. The six ways to make people like you, I think that's pretty good. Smiling is one good thing. And becoming interested in other people, because you know, a lot of these things are very hard to do. I mean, because the way society is today, it has most of the people today thinking just the opposite. Because when you think of do unto others as you would have them do unto you, they've even changed that around to do unto others before they do unto you. And you know, if a person don't really know the original text or the idea behind that, you may even, you know, get the wrong impression. You may not even know the right way. So, you know, a lot of this stuff I think we should give some serious thought to. And it should be able to help us in our dealing with others, especially other non-white people, because the situation is getting, you know, worse. The way we treat each other and the way that we interact. You know, we recently had a guy that failed a urinalysis test at the job, and he had like 28 or almost 30 years. And, you know, he had like 4 or 5 weeks to go or whatever. And then just to hear some of the comments, we're all mostly non-white black people working there.
And to hear those comments, you know, no sympathy for the guy. You know, if you have a problem with alcohol, you know, that's a disease. So there should be some help available for him. But a lot of the people are saying, you know, he deserves what he gets and he should lose his entire retirement. And I'm just like shocked. It's like, where does all this anti-blackness come from? You know, this program is really a serious thing. And one last thing I'll say about arguing. I believe that you can't win an argument. And even if you do win, it's going to create resentment. You know, but it brought up a question in my mind. The difference in an argument and a debate. And white people love to debate. So if somebody's got some feedback on that, I'd like to hear the difference in an argument and a debate. I'll mute my line.
I think that's a good point. I know, just thinking off top, I have had debates with strangers. You tend to have arguments with people where there's some sort of emotional connection. Like you have an argument with your boyfriend or your girlfriend. You have an argument with your child or your parents or your siblings. People that you have some sort of connection to. I mean, debates. Sometimes you have debates where you randomly pick a side. I mean, you know, I feel like debates, I mean, even though you are opposing someone and you disagree, it's extremely detached. Sometimes the side that you take in the debate can be random. So that's the major difference that I see. It seems, at least to me, it seems like there's a more personal stake with regards to an argument and a debate. And I think at least with victims of racism, I think a lot of times, even when we're having disagreements on racism, white supremacy, it seems like a lot of times it gets personal. And I'll mute my line there. Probably because of the programming and anti-blackness that was mentioned. It might not even be that it gets personal, but it might just be because of that anti-blackness. Either things are taken personal because of just the abuse. It's just another criticism. You're already close, like I said earlier, and or because of that programming and anti-blackness, people that we don't agree with because of the programming. If it's a non-white person, we might be a little more personally disparaging with those that we disagree with. Now, mute my line. No one seems to have any other thoughts on that. I do think that's worth pondering, the arguments and the anti-black aspect. I can't say I'm surprised about the lack of compassion for the unfortunate coworker or former coworker. That's the way. And the sad thing about how deep the conditioning, I strongly suspect it would have been a different response if it had been a white person. That I could be incorrect. Maybe they would have been just as callous about it if it had been a white person. But my general thinking is that we tend to be a lot more. That's what you get. You know, you do the crime, you do the time. That's what you get. That's the point. I mean, we tend to be much more punitive about those sorts of things when it's a dark person, as opposed to it being a white person. Then it's much more the, oh my gosh, I can't believe that. And, you know, that exactly what you said. That's a sickness, you know? And did he try to get, I mean, it's all of us, myself included. It's just a part of our victimization. But I think that plays right into, it goes hand in hand with the arguments and why I think it gets, ugly and personal so quickly, that anti-blackness. I mean, if you're seeing anti-blackness, and it sounds like you're probably right, if what you've been describing, if you're seeing that sort of behavior around someone losing a job, and this is an older person, if you said he'd been working there, this is not a young whippersnapper, no big deal, bounce right back, whatever. This is an older person close to retirement. If you're seeing that sort of callous, disconnected disconcern, then, you know, I can just imagine it would have to be worse if now I'm feeling like, you know, this person doesn't agree with me and, you know, they're talking crazy or whatever their viewpoint is. I just can easily see how it can go downhill. That's why I said earlier, I mean, I don't even often feel the need to announce whether or not I agree with something. I think Mr. Fuller says that over and over. You're not looking for consensus. United, independent, it's not like you're trying to get everybody, you know, to agree to something. There should be a few little things that we can agree on and maybe get something done. And then maybe on a smaller level work to see where we have points where we agree. But I mean, it's really just more about understanding, well, if white people are the problem, then we're all trying to do what we're trying to do to solve that problem, not getting everybody to come over and agree with me, or, you know, nobody can take a different perspective on racism, white supremacy, and what should be done about the problem. I think that's just real important to keep that in mind. And, just with, again, I guess make sure nobody gets that confused. Just with victims, don't feel compelled to, you know, point out everything that the person's saying that you don't agree with. I thought that was a great illustration that they gave in the book when, you know, he pointed out that the person was giving an incorrect anecdote. I think he was saying that it was in the Bible, and it wasn't. He was saying it's in Shakespeare, and, you know, hey, he didn't ask for your input. He didn't want it. I mean, hey, let's understand the context, the setting that we're in before we go off on trying to show somebody up. I think that's real important, because I think non-white people, that's just all day long, just having people, white people, non-white people, everybody come in and tell us, you did that wrong, you did this wrong, you screwed that up. Like, you know, if it's a non-white person, unless it's life-threatening, unless this is going to mess you up or someone in your family or what have you, if it's something small, like they mispronounced something or gave a wrong reference, probably can let that slide. No need to have a big blow up about pointing out, even if you are correct. The person 4028, your line should be open as well. 4028.
Yes. I was thinking about the argument section in the book and non-white people. You know, you were saying that an argument is typically with someone who there's emotion involved and you're close to them, or you have some kind of emotional bond to them or whatever. And I think maybe that's one of the reasons why you can't have a civil conversation with some non-white people about racism, because they feel emotionally bonded to white people.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, so I don't know, but I mean, all I could think of when I was listening to the session is just nodding my head. You know, I mean, I've learned as I got older that I didn't think I was being combative or argumentative, but, I mean, you have to always think of what's the purpose of your dialogue in the first place, you know, and even if you do make your point, like he said, the purpose oftentimes wasn't to win. It was to get somebody, in terms of, okay, you made the better point, but it was to actually get somebody to think or at least be open to your idea. But, you know, if you argue them, down. Even if you're successful, they shut down. And any attempts to plant seeds in the future is almost null and void. I don't know. Just my take.
Ashe, I agree 1,000%. I think we've heard a lot, at least I've heard a lot in programs over the past week or so from callers talking about residual impact. You know, you can have a conversation, a disagreement with a victim, and if it's courteous, even if there's a lack of agreement, if it's courteous, they will think about what was said. They'll think about the conversation, the disagreement. They'll think mm-hmm. about it. Could be a month, could be 2 months, could be a year, could be 5 years down the road where they say, man, I don't know. I might need to reconsider. Maybe what you said was making sense. If the less courteous you are, I think you start to dramatically drop the likelihood of that happening. Once you start, you know, when it's rude and I'm going to show this person and you're wrong and whatever it is that you're, I think once it gets to that level, you know, people kind of just buckle down and just for pride's sake, like we all got egos and everything that goes with that. So, yeah, I think that's one that I try to employ. Like you said earlier, your first point about it's difficult to have conversations with victims sometimes because we're white identified. That's a part of our victimization. Mm-hmm. We got those emotional attachments to other white people. I try to catch that like early. If I think, oh, this person has a white parent, this person is married to a white person, they're sexually involved with a white person or whatever, this person, you know, has that connection to white people, or they're confused or whatever is causing them to not want to address this or to be emotional about this, catch that early on and stop. I'm not trying to convince mm-hmm. them. I'm not trying to win them over and look at how many books I read. That totally irrelevant. Okay, that's your right on. Cool in the gang. Fine. And listen courteously, let them finish and then, you know, move forward. I have found that that is way better than having a long 5-hour argument where the people never speak again for the next 10 years. Like, yeah.
That is a very good point. I had to catch myself recently because I don't know if I actually said it in this way, but I was thinking it in my mind. Someone was speaking about how there weren't any available black men for black women, and that black women were forced to have to seek out, you know, white men or some other nationality or race or whatever, because there were no available black men. And, you know, I was thinking to myself, that is the stupidest thing that I've ever heard. And I don't know if I said that, but I implied it in a way like that is completely incorrect. I think it's a cop-out. And then we got into a heated discussion about that because I had to clear it up. I was working with a young college-age black men, and I was meeting numerous young black men with promising careers. They were in college and they were getting ready to graduate. They had moral values. They had everything going for them. I could not just sit there and accept something. I may have been wrong. I could have said, well, I may be incorrect, but from my view, you know, I see it from a different perspective. I think it's a matter of preference. And I know that a lot of black males are in prison. They may have prior arrest records or whatever. You know, there may be a shortage of black men. But I don't know. I just have a hard time thinking that black women would need to seek out, you know, other sources of companionship.
You know, like I was, you know, the whole thing he was saying about arguing, is that, yeah, I was thinking that oftentimes when we argue, it's like we forget that a dialogue is supposed to be an exchange. And no matter how much a person is, or you feel or you perceive a person is whitewashed, they have a valid point from their perspective, you know. And I have learned that if I acknowledge the fact that they have a valid point from their perspective and ask them to elaborate on it, you know, or share it, then I can say, well, you know, I understand where you're coming from. You know, I used to think like that, but then such and such happened, and now I think this way, you know. So you're not combating necessarily what their point was, you know, because it's real from their perspective, you know, and you're just showing them in a way when you don't combat it, or you, in other words, you engage in an exchange, not just me trying to teach you or me trying to enlighten you, you know. You can learn from anybody, you know, anyone, you know, you can even learn, I believe, from racists, you know. So, I mean, I'm trying to take, even though sometimes, now I say this, but sometimes, you know, emotions run high and I have to just kind of breathe and, like, you know, have to try not to get into anti-blackness. But, yeah, I mean, I just try to, it's not about you. It's not about you proving your point or you lecturing somebody else. It's about an exchange. You're going to learn something from this conversation as well, you know. If nothing more, you'll learn how to engage with another victim in a better light. You know, if anything, at least, you know, you'll learn that much. Okay, so I know next time not to do that. That's the wrong angle, you know. Perhaps I should have been more subtle, less direct, or, you know.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Can learn quite a bit talking to other victims and patients, which is very important. We are going to need the non-white people that are confused to get more of them who are to get them to become less confused and interested in racism, white supremacy. So patience, patience, patience. And listening, I think we've heard that repeatedly. I wanted to read a quick section. We still got about 12 minutes left in the program. If folks want to participate, don't wait till the last minute. The section, we got another Lincoln reference, the racism, white supremacy, going hand in hand with Lincoln, where Carnegie says Lincoln once reprimanded a young army officer for indulging in violent controversy with an associate. No man who is resolved to make the most of himself, said Lincoln, can spare time for personal contention. Still less can he afford to take the consequences, including the vitiation of his temper and the loss of self-control. Yield larger things to which you show no more than equal rights, and yield lesser ones, though clearly your own. Better give your path to a dog than be bitten by him in contesting for the right. Even killing the dog would not cure the bite. Now, again, this, in my view, this would be applicable to non-white people, for the most part, non-white people, victims of racism. Continuing, he says in an article in Bits and Pieces, some suggestions are made on how to keep a disagreement from becoming an argument. Welcome the disagreement. Remember the slogan, when two partners always agree, one of them is not necessary. If there is some point you haven't thought about, be thankful it is brought to your attention. Perhaps this disagreement is your opportunity to be corrected before you make a serious mistake. Distrust your first instinctive impression. Our first natural reaction in a disagreeable situation is to be defensive. Be careful. Keep calm and watch out for your first reaction. It may be you at your worst, not your best. Control your temper. Remember, you can measure the size of a person by what makes him or her angry. Listen first. Give your opponents a chance to talk. Let them finish. Do not resist, defend, or debate. This only raises barriers. Try to build bridges of understanding. Don't build higher barriers of misunderstanding. Look for areas of agreement. When you have heard your opponents out, dwell first on the points and areas on which you agree. Be honest. Look for areas where you can admit error and say so. Apologize for your mistakes. It will help disarm your opponents and reduce defensiveness. Thought those were some great strategies that can and should be applied to other victims of racism. Mute my line.
That was excellent. I just want to say one other thing. I was reading when they were referring to Benjamin Franklin. Now, Benjamin Franklin had an extraordinary life, career, an inventor, printer, and all these things that he did. And obvious, intelligent individual. And one of the so-called founding fathers. My question was, these guys were so intelligent and ahead of their time. Why did so many of them have it wrong when it came to enslaving other human beings? So I contemplated on that a little bit. And then I started to think, you know, that time, that was done purposely. And they were aware of the economic effect of free labor and a total disregard for another human being. And they even objectify the other human beings as to not make them human in their own mind. And if you think about that, that's not intelligent in itself. So, I don't know, I think that has something to do with the beginning or the beginning of the establishment of white supremacy. Do you have any views on Benjamin Franklin?
From what I know of him, he has public material where he talks about what I would label as just using different words to express Dr. Welsing's theory of white genetic annihilation and talking about the disparity between the number of white and non-white people on the planet. He, in my view, from the material that I've read, someone who would clearly be labeled as a racist white supremacist. Just by his own testimony, by his own hand. So I guess when you say he had it wrong, he and some of the other quote unquote great minds of that time period, colonial America, what they call it, they didn't have it wrong from their perspective. They had it right. White is right. We're supposed to dominate. They had it right. That's the same worldview. I know, you know, you're asking like these guys are supposed to be so intelligent, then why didn't they have it correct with regards to how they see non-white people? And that's white people. I mean, at any time, any century, a white person understands what it means to be white. Like if they ever have time travel or what have you, white people will not be confused about that at all. If I'm a racist in 2013, if I go back to 1813, I'm good. You might need to catch me up on the lingo or what have you, but regards to black people, I got that. either way, I'm good. You might need to, if I go from the 19th century to the 21st century, you might have to, you know, give me a while, catch me up on this iPhone and whatever. But the niggers, I got Paula Deen, I got that. I already know. And I support her. Where can I, you know, hear her show and all? Like, white people are not confused about racism.
You can't be confused. Yeah, they can't be confused or ignorant if it's systemic, because a system denotes a design. And there has to be a designer. You know, it can't be the same everywhere on the planet and just, oh, I'm just ignorantly, unconsciously practicing racism. Nah, the logic does just not hold up.
But that is generally what they claim, that they're unaware of. They just don't know. And that it is non-white people's responsibility to let them know. We all know that that's incorrect.
I don't argue that point either. That's another one, even though, you know, it seems blatant. It's 1 + 1 = 2, you know, kindergarten. I don't argue that either. And that's one that I learned very early on. Once I came to the conclusion what it means to be a white person, I don't argue about that. If I'm not, I don't try to convince. I don't even bring it up. There's certain things, the sex thing, no sex between white people and non-white people. That's another one. I might not even bring it up if I see that the person is confused, because I'll already know that it's very unlikely that they will listen to what I have to say, that it likely will just provoke conflict and argument. I won't be heard. I mean, if you can see that the person is already confused and or they're not receptive, they're not really interested in hearing a different perspective on racism, then, you know. Hey, Mr. Fuller always encourages to, you know, let people talk about this when they want to, when they're showing that they're interested and this is something that they want to begin to explore. So I thought it was great when one of the little anecdotes, I'll see if I can read it, I highlight it. He said, my first problem was not to teach Patrick J. O'Hare to talk. My immediate task was to train him to refrain from talking and to avoid verbal bites. I think that is a huge one with non-white people. And I noticed this even with the code book. I think I heard Mr. Edward Williams and Mr. Fuller. I think I heard them doing a discussion years ago, like long, long time ago. And he was saying, I think Mr. Williams was asking Mr. Fuller, and he was saying, this is what it was. Mr. Fuller was talking to Mr. Williams, and he said years ago, someone told Mr. Fuller, I think they heard him at a lecture or whatever. And he said, you know something? These people are not really interested in, you know, what you're talking about, like a long-term change in behavior and really getting serious about dealing with life. He's like, they are not interested in that at all. They just want to come and argue and debate one another and have a good time arguing amongst other victims. And he said, you know, there's a lot of that. And I called and asked him about that, because the code book, it has questions for white people, encouraging you to go out and ask white people. And I found that frequently non-white people, one of our favorite hobbies is to sit around, shadow box, and argue with one another about racism. Who understands it the best? Who knows what it is? Who knows how it works? Who knows what should be done about it? We enjoy that. Going upside one another's head, calling somebody stupid. We want to prove them wrong. Frequently, I think that's a lot of times, that's what we're looking at. Mr. Fuller said that. I think he said that on one of our first programs. He said, friend, this is another one that I check out for. If I feel this has the feeling not of a discussion, but this is an argument, this is somebody that wants to mud wrestle, I immediately shut down. Avoid verbal fights. If they're doing a lot of interrupting, where they're doing name calling, where they're making it clear that this is not going to be a courteous exchange, I go ahead and shut down. I don't tell them to be quiet, but I stop talking. Eventually, if you're not going to respond, they'll go ahead and stop talking eventually. But I have seen a lot of that where black, and it's part of our grooming. The sound clip at the beginning, that's how we've been trained. We look forward for opportunities to fuss and gripe with one another as though this is somehow working against racism, and we'll feel proud of talking down and belittling other black people. I've participated in it. I've watched it. It's shameful. It's shameful, and it's something we should all be looking to make sure that we really are not participating in. I know it can be tough. We all fall in from time to time, but we should all be, hey, I'm going to make sure I do everything that I can to avoid these little petty, going nowhere squabbles with other victims of racism. We have about 4 minutes left. If anybody wants to participate.
Well, this is kind of off the subject, but kind of on the subject too. A while ago, you were saying something about Jews and how they treated people who were deemed or could have been argued as traitors, and you said, and you named a group of those Jews, and I was trying to do research, but I couldn't remember the name you said that they were labeled on that.
The Sounder Commander. That's
Sounder
the name.
Commander.
The Sounder Commando. I'll spell it out for you. There was a term that was used in the book also. I'm just going off the page. That's why I'm saying it now. Non compos mentis. That was the term that was used. It's Latin. And it means not of sound mind. I had to look it up just because I don't know Latin. I'm a victim of racism. But that's what the term means. Non compos mentis. Not of sound mind. It was saying if you get into an argument and you've taken the position that this person is non compos mentis, then that doesn't mean that you go to town and give them what for, that you still are patient and courteous. But the Sounder Commando, it is spelled kind of strange because I think it's spelled in German. Okay, it's S-O-N-D-E-R. K-O-M-M-A-N-D-O, Sounder Commando. Sounder Commando, it's all one word. They have a Wikipedia page, lots of articles. They have interviews. There's a documentary on YouTube with some of the members who were alive until recently. Mr. Fuller has talked about this pretty regularly. I talked to him about it a couple times towards the end of 2012. And it was about this very subject, Shadowbox. And I said, it's going to skyrocket. And I even hear this from people who understand racism, white supremacy. It's massive problem. White people know this. They've groomed us. They are just turning that signal up. It's just going to be more and more black people getting it. Other black people, you really are going to have to be. We really are going to have to be on the ball about not getting into other arguments, fights with other victims of racism, and making sure that we are not directing our anger at other victims. The problem is white people. But the Sounder Commando, Mr. Fuller brought them up because he was saying for individuals who say, well, the problem is President Obama. The problem is Susan Rice. The problem is Clarence Thomas. Or whomever, insert non-white person's name. He was saying that the Sounder Commando, these were so-called Jews during Nazi Germany that had uniforms. They were like a quote-unquote official group under the Nazis. And they would be charged with doing certain duties each day in the camps. And they did these things, they got better treatment and what have you. And he said that this is known, it's documented, there have been books written, as I just said, documentaries, blah, blah, blah. He said that these people are not picked on, they're not called traitors, the Jews don't go around calling them Uncle Toms and saying that you're not welcome here and get out of Israel. None of that. They are viewed as victims. He says it's very simple when you are in that sort of weak position, as all non-white people are. Either you can go and be a part of the Sounder Commando, quote unquote, Uncle Tom. You can go be whatever and help us out, or you can go in the oven. Make a choice. You got 5 seconds, whichever you want to do. And he said, it's very clear. You understand that regardless of which choice you make, you understand you're in a weak position. And I don't really have a quote unquote choice. Every organism on the planet wants to survive. All of us have that instinct, and someone doing whatever to survive, that's just them doing what they, that is a victim responding to being terrorized and dominated. And he said that the Jews understand this, so-called Jews. You don't hear them talking bad about the Sounder Commando. You don't hear them blaming them for anything that happened. They're victims of racism, and it seems like everybody's on the same page about that. And he was saying that non-white people should take the exact same approach to all non-white people, as opposed to fussing and complaining about other non-white people victims of racism and how they respond to white supremacy. Specifically saying all of the individuals that we think of as being so-called Uncle Toms, sellouts, helping out the racists, it's these people's fault that we can't get our act together. He was saying that as long as the system of white supremacy exists, racists can replace them faster than you can take them out. If they all were to drop dead in the next 10 minutes, nothing about our situation would change. He likened it to getting a mop to try to dry up Niagara Falls.
Okay, thank you. I found it. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking about the whole racial showcasing aspect, and I was like, well, how do you, I get the whole Sounder Commando approach, but if that is a tactic used by white supremacy, and if the approach is don't engage them, then aren't you kind of at a standstill? Because if there's no method of addressing people who are placed in a racial showcasing aspect, then and we haven't developed a codified way other than just don't mess with them to deal with it, then won't the racists keep putting those racial showcases there because it's effective? If that makes any sense. I don't know if I'm talking in circles.
It does make sense. I'll see if I can answer as we wrap things up. Valid point. At least my view, and I could be incorrect, that I think they were talking about that having debate. Very good to not immediately start off, you know, thinking that you got it all together. I think being able to admit that we're still learning, I think that can be very helpful too. My view is, with regards to the showcasing, I think for the racists, racial showcasing is effective when non-white people begin to devote their time and energy to the victims who are being showcased as being the problem. When that starts to happen, I think racists are happy. When non-white people start in a system of white supremacy talking about the problem with President Obama, ..
Gotcha.
They are happy. Now, I could be wrong, but I would have to. If I'm a white person, we are the minority on the planet. We are in charge of everything. You wouldn't even know President Obama if it wasn't for us. He wouldn't be there if it wasn't for us. If we do this and then we look out at the people we call niggers, we look out at them and they're, damn that Obama, I can't believe he went over there and damn Obama this, and he didn't say anything about it. Man, I'm ecstatic. It is party time. Plan is working well. They are not focused on us at all. They're griping about other niggers. As long as niggers are complaining about niggers, A plus. That's when it's being effective. Now, when non-white people are saying, I might not be pleased with what President Obama did, but I understand we're still in a system of racism, white supremacy, and he's not in charge. Now, that's very different. And I have not heard that. I heard a victim of racism. As I said at the beginning, he spent a lot of time on Democracy Now with Amy Goodman. This is what I mean when I say racist. They had to see this and smile. I could be wrong, but They had to be elated. You have a white woman who gets to say nothing. We just talked about that. Understanding when to be. She doesn't say a word. You can't even accuse her of talking bad or bashing President Obama because she didn't say a word. She didn't even ask him any questions, basically. She just let this non-white person talk and blame President Obama for not talking about reparations and not talking about racism and not talking about AFRICOM and directing attention away from Nelson Mandela and all of these different things. And he's a victim of racism. He's guaranteed qualified. But at the end of the day, if we're in a system of racism, white supremacy, it's possible that white people are the ones who are responsible for President Obama, what he said or didn't say. Ghostwriter, I'll bring that up again. Mr. Flaherty, second mention on the program with Clarence Pendleton, where you got a white person who admits, I used to write speeches for this black person that were about racism, things that were considered quote unquote inflammatory, where you got a black person saying things where he was being accused of being an Uncle Tom and a sellout, maybe somewhat a victim who was being showcased, where you got a white person saying, I was doing this, I was writing, and he was just being given credit for things that I wrote. I suspect that could be happening with President Obama. I suspect that that could easily happen with any non-white person on the planet. And I think as long as non-white people forget that, minimize that, kid ourselves about the fact that regardless of what President Obama is doing, not doing, saying, not saying, he, like every other non-white person, I think, in the universe, if you got a job, if you're under the system of racism, white supremacy, directly or indirectly, white people will let you know what you can and you can't do. Mm-hmm. That's one of those where I make a statement. That's another one I employ when I make statements. I don't argue because I could be wrong. Maybe that's not true, but I've concluded that I think that's true. That people want to argue and fight and say that that's not true. I've had that happen before where someone said, no, that's not true. I live in this area of the world. White people don't tell me what to do. They don't make any rules here. They don't have any authority here. Okay. I could be wrong. And we leave it there. But in my mind, I still think now, wherever they think they are in the world, if white people want to blow that up in the next 5 minutes, I think it would be gone. I definitely don't think any black people would have the muscle to stop white people from doing whatever they want to do in that area. And I don't think any other non-white people do either. That's just one of those. It's no arguing. I say there's a system of white supremacy. I think Mr. Fuller, Dr. Welsing, many other folks would encourage taking the stance. Once you think there's a system of white supremacy, you ascertain the people that you're talking to. If they think that exists, if they understand what that means, and if they think it exists. If they don't, then that, hey, we might not have anything to talk about. If we do, I'm going to keep that in mind in the discussion to make sure that I'm not off arguing with someone who's confused. If they do, but we have a difference of opinion, that's fine too. But I'm of the opinion that I think the showcasing has been very effective. It's going to continue to be effective because of the anti-blackness. I think that's one of our favorite hobbies. It's scary to deal with white people. It's a lot more fun to find a black person to name call, bash, and blame. Dealing with white people is scary, can be lethal. And I think most of us, directly or indirectly, we know that. I'll stop there because I feel like we're at the end. I feel like I've talked, and we can talk about this one tomorrow. We have more time and people can give their input. I know a lot of folks out there do not agree, and that's fine too. Call in tomorrow. You can share your views and we can continue the subject matter. 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Central, and 6 p.m. Pacific. Thanks everyone for being patient today. It was difficult with the phone lines. Hopefully that will not happen tomorrow. The free HD line hopefully will be working correctly and we can get rolling on time without the difficulties. It has been challenging, but we got through it. Third session is complete. I think we have about three more to go before we're done with Mr. Carnegie's book. I hope it is giving some constructive information. It has been a hoot to go back and hear it again. I always enjoy reading this book. One last quote before we conclude the program. I thought this was pretty good one. I think non-white people, I think someone last week they called in, it was a female, and she asked, what do you do if you have non-white people that don't speak? Like if you're on your job or someplace, if they're non-white people and they don't speak. And I was saying, you know, hey, keep it pushing. If they're random people, just don't worry about it. Keep moving. If they, you know, if you know them and they're just ignoring you and not speaking, then, you know, don't get upset about that either. Just keep it moving. anti-blackness is thick, just keep it going, do have the courage to make a second attempt. The anti-blackness has conditioned us all. I think that is a courageous thing, to have the ability to make a second or third or fourth attempt. For a victim, not for white people, obviously, but for victims, to reach out, to try to be nice. Not if the person is hostile and they mistreated you, what have you, certainly. But I mean, if it's just they're being distant or what have you, they're kind of standoffish, make an effort. Make an effort. A lot of us have been mistreated. All of us have been mistreated. So have the courage. Try. I'm not saying that I do that well myself. I'm pretty curmudgeon. You know, I don't shout about that. But if you can muster the courage to reach out to a victim, definitely do so. And this passage kind of reminded me of that, where Carnegie says he was talking about the male who complimented this other white person, I presume, about his hair, and the guy, you know, got really, I guess he really appreciated that and warmed up to him after he made this comment about his hair. And so he shared this story with another person, and the person that he shared it with says, "Oh, wow, what did you get out of him for giving him this compliment?" And the guy responds, he says, "What was I trying to get out of him? What was I trying to get out of him? If we are so contemptibly selfish that we can't radiate a little happiness and pass on a bit of honest appreciation without trying to get something out of the other person in return, if our souls are no bigger than sour crab apples, we shall meet with the failure we so richly deserve." Thought that was a good one, to reach out, make that effort, when you don't even need anything, just to reach out. If you can say something kind, pleasant about another non-white person, do so. If you can help out another non-white person when you don't need anything, just trying to help out another victim, looking out for another victim, if you can do so, try to do so. I think that can also really open the door up for people being receptive, down the road to hearing about racism, white supremacy. We will be back about 24 hours. Remain safe and constructive. Context of White Supremacy signing out. The blog racism-notes.blogspot.com. The Kanye West album review is up. Should have other content posted soon as well, even on shadowboxing, because I did get a chance to see the paper. They had anti-blackness front and center in the New York Times this week and frequently. But that should be posted as well. racism-notes.blogspot.com. Invest if you think the program is constructive. Thanks for your patience and tuning in. Cows signing out.
I'm a victim, brother.
You're a victim.
Man, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.